Previously on Lost.
Do you really think all this is an accident? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, John?
The island.
They've attacked us, sabotaged us, abducted us, murdered us. We're not the only people on this island, and we all know it.
So I guess I'm out of the book club.
Two players, two sides. One is light, one is dark.
I see you in another life, brother. We have to go back. We have to go back. We have to go back. We have to go back.
Never count him out. He's always coming back. It's Mikhail.
We're going to need to watch that again.
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost rewatch podcast for season 3, episodes 22 and 23. Through the Looking Glass, it's the season finale of season 3. I have a question for everybody at the top of this podcast. The keypad to your jamming signal plays what melody? My name is Dave Gonzalez, and it plays do 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 do. Do do the I Love Lucy theme.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and it plays the only theme that I'm pretty sure I could like knock out pretty quickly on a keypad, which is Hot Cross Buns.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I also only have really one that I could remember, and it comes from the movie Short Circuit 2, and it's Help Me Rhonda, Help, Help Me Rhonda.
I like you keeping it in the Beach Boys family. That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah, I try.
We are here to discuss the season 3 finale. If this is your first time joining us, welcome. This podcast is an ideal companion if you're rewatching Lost with us or visiting the island for the very first time, because each episode comes in sections for your listening pleasure. First, a calm section that only discusses the preceding episodes and avoids all spoilers, and then a second section called The Storm. It's a storm of spoilers discussing this week's episode in the context of the entire series and over a decade of Lost fandom. This week, we have two interviews where, Joanna, who are you talking to this week?
Oh my gosh, two incredible human beings are here this week. First of all, we've got Jen Chaney from New York Magazine, Vulture. You may know her. She's an incredible TV critic and writer. She covered Lost way back in the day. She's got a really cool Lost project on the horizon that our listeners are going to hear about. So you're going to want to listen to what Jen has to say about this episode. And then we also have a returning guest, Huai Chambui, who was on in season one to talk about, the first Sun and Jin episode, asked to come back to talk about this finale, to talk about her boys, as she puts it, Charlie and Desmond. So, she's here to talk about the Fate boys. Jen is here to talk about Sad Jack, and we're all going to have a great time.
We're going to intersperse those interviews in the column because they will be spoiler-free. So even more so this week than other weeks, but every week, you will look down on your podcast device and see time codes that indicate when the column, the interview, and the storm, and, well, in this case, the second interview, when they all start, so you could skip around to your listening pleasure. If you would like to support the show more than you already are just for listening and hopefully be subscribing, you go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers, where you can subscribe in a different way and get monthly bonus content from us at different subscription levels. This includes bonus podcasts, access to our Slack, where we do watch-alongs, and our Slack community has taken upon it itself to do some fun, spooky season watch-alongs even beyond us. But we will be in there every Saturday watching an episode of Lost along with you. We also have the bonus podcast I was talking about would be the three of us talking about things other than Lost, answering mailbag questions submitted by our Patreon subscribers, and Joanna has two little bonus podcasts she's been running, and they both are in different levels of subscription at patreon.com/StarWarsSpoilers. Joanna, tell us about Feels Like the First Time and what I call Chen Pop.
Chen Pop. Chen Pop is when I like hop on the phone and talk to Dave Chen sometimes. So we will be doing our final recap of Lovecraft Country coming up pretty soon, because the series, or the season at least, is almost over. So we will be reconvening at the end of this season of Lovecraft Country to talk about the whole shebang. And that's for our $10 subscribers. And then if you subscribe at any level, you can hang out with Kristen Russo and me as we watch movies that one or both of us hasn't seen for the first time. And this time, this month, we are splitting custody on some Halloween movies. We got in a text fight last night. Chris and I are very good friends. Wow. We are very good friends. And we got in a text fight last night because I tried to weasel out of watching Hocus Pocus, only because here's my deal on Hocus Pocus, guys. I like Hocus Pocus, but I don't love Hocus Pocus. And it feels like in order to be an American citizen, I have to watch Hocus Pocus every single dang year. And I don't like it that much. So Kristen really wanted, she like basically we're picking three movies. One is her choice. One is my choice. And then the third, she said, is Hocus Pocus. And I was like, can the third be The Craft instead? And she tried to end our friendship. So we are watching Hocus Pocus and maybe also The Craft. And then a film of Chris's choosing, which is Nightmare on Elm Street. And a film of my choosing. And I haven't picked what mine is yet. I don't know what Halloween movie that Kristen hasn't seen will be the most hilarious to hear us guess, hear her guess about. So I'm still working on mine. But we're going to be watching some spooky Halloween-themed movies this month with Kristen Russo. What a treat. What a treat. What a joy for us. How lucky are we? So, yeah, so that's
incredibly spookily lucky.
So that's something our our Patreons can enjoy. I want to shout out, you know, something else that we do in the Patreon every weekend is we watch the latest episode of Lost, you know, the one that we're going to cover on the podcast the following week. So that, you know, this upcoming week, we're going to be watching the season four premiere. I want to shout out a couple things. First of all, that was originated by one of our moderators, Shruti, like sort of came up with the idea, but it's been like a really fun thing to do. And a bunch of people showed up this last weekend for the season three finale watch, and which happened to land on my birthday. And everyone was just so nice to me that, you know, how like, you know, how like everything's terrible and like bad in the world. When we were done watching those 2 hours of Lost over the weekend and everyone was just being really nice to me because it was my birthday, I was just like, I turned to Diana, our producer, who was watching with me, and I was like, is this what being happy feels like? Because I forgot. So I was just like beaming from ear to ear because everyone was so sweet and nice, and it was just such a good time. So, and we tried our best to keep the commies as, like, you know, protected and spoiler-free as possible. So, yeah, join us in the Patreon Slack every weekend for, you know, Dave is going to be hosting this weekend, the beginning of the end, the season four premiere. So you wanna do that. You can also tweet at us at Storm Podcast. That's where you can like vote on our Kistry poll, which we will get to later in this episode, etc. You can also email us, host@stormpodcast.com. You can find out what we're up to, including like what our movie club pick is that we watch with our Patreon subscribers, what our book club pick is, like all this sort of stuff, extra stuff that we do outside of the Lost Podcast over on our website, stormpodcast.com. And then you can also always leave us a review. So I'm going to read a review real quick, which is it's a real fun one this week, and then I'll read an email and then we will roll on with our lives. This is an update from an earlier review, so I'm going to read the original review, and I can't remember how many stars it was originally, but it was not five before. It is five now. Okay, so before it said, and I read this recently, so you guys might remember it, Kay Bree wrote, I was excited to hear after Game of Thrones wrapped up that the show would be back and revisit Lost. However, three episodes in and the podcasts are disordered and confusing, with each host seeming to talk at random about different things and no attempt at coherence or logically moving from one topic or scene to the next. Also, there are constant references to the commentary on the DVD set, fan websites, and sometimes deleted scenes, none of which seem to me relevant to the experience of the show as it existed. Love the show, love what these hosts did with Game of Thrones, wish they could get it together on Lost. And so Kay Bree wrote this updated review that reads, editing my original review to say the hosts did get it together, and this podcast is a fun and insightful look at the show. Lost, one of my all-time TV faves. All three hosts bring their own worthwhile perspectives, and it is a joy to listen to each week. So much that I criticized in those early weeks' discussion about DVD commentary, deleted scenes, has thankfully been dropped, and after several false starts with interviews, some of those early ones were truly cringeworthy. Thank you! The guests are all knowledgeable and enthusiastic about the episodes slash characters they discuss and have something to say. So, we have improved in the eyes of at least one listener. So, you know, pat yourself on the back, guys. Good job.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because, I feel like we talk even more about what the writer's room was doing now than we did before, but maybe, you know.
Maybe not exactly in those terms, perhaps. Hey,
whatever gets the job done, I always say.
Well, as we now we know for sure the villain's locked, so things are about to get much easier to decode.
Sure. Nope. I will be arguing with you later. Okay. And then our email this week, we got a lot of good emails, but I'm just going to keep it to one because we have a lot to discuss and two guests and all this stuff. But this one came from Michael, who wrote in kind of with a thought prompt. The title is Lost Babies, but it's not what you think. Michael writes, greeting from an undisclosed hatch. Joanna recently mentioned Once Upon a Time, and my wife randomly started watching the show to distract from our government's Best Weekend at Bernie's impression, and it got me thinking of all the shows Lost writers and creators have spawned since it stopped airing. So here's my question. What is the best show in the Lost cinematic universe? And then there's some asterisks here, and Michael wrote, we all know it's Watchmen, so let's find the second best. And then another asterisk says, okay, The Leftovers is second, so Copper it is. So third prize goes to, so here's the final graph of Mike's email. Let's keep it to shows created or run by a Lost alum. From my memory, if we include JJ, Damon, Carlton in the writer's room, there is Fringe, Alcatraz, Once Upon a Time, Lock and Key, Amazing Stories, Zoo, Bates Motel, The Strained, The Return, Jack Ryan, and then Mike wrote, man, Carlton gets around a lot. Person of interest, ? I'm sure I'm missing others. What would you pick as the third best Lost baby? So let me reiterate. Fringe, Alcatraz, Once Upon a Time, Lock and Key, Amazing Stories, Zoo, Bates Motel, The Strain, The Return, Jack Ryan, Person of Interest. I might add...
My choice is definitely not on that list.
Okay.
Because it's not recognized. It's not a full season that was run by a Lost alum, but it was a project started under a Lost alum, and I guess I'm answering now, so I'll jump in and say...
Okay.
The first half of Netflix's Daredevil, run by Drew Goddard, is like my favorite.
Mine is also Drew Goddard inspired. I'm going to say The Good Place, which Michael Schur borrowed heavily from Lost and leaned on Drew Goddard for a lot of, you know, Drew Goddard directed the pilot and like consulted with Michael Schur on how to create it. And there's just so much DNA and like in common between The Good Place and Lost. So I'm going to claim The Good Place. What do you say, Neil?
I'm going to stay within the confines of our listener Michael's lovely email.
Someone should answer the prompt.
And it's easy. It's Fringe. Fringe is great. That's JJ, right?
Wait,
JJ also.
Yeah, but JJ, it's like, it's weird. It's weird for me to think. Yeah, it's weird. Well, it's also weird for me to think of like a JJ show as like a lost baby when like JJ did it. Like Lost is sort of like an alias baby. You know what I mean? Let me see if I can reenact a Fringe conversation that happened in front of me that I tried to follow, even though I have only watched some of Fringe. My two friends were talking about Fringe and whether or not it was a good show, and then and they were like, yeah, it was really good until Folivia. Yeah, and then what did you call Walter? Is there like a fake Walter, like faux Walter? I don't know.
Oh, I don't remember.
But it was
like Evil Walter.
Yeah, but it was like Folivia, and then like whatever name they came up with for like Walter, they're like, until Folivia, oh yeah, and then blah blah blah. And I was like, this is kind of like Greek, but I can kind of parse it at the
first
same time.
Folivia season. I go for because Anna Torv is a powerhouse, but
Mindhunter. Okay,
It also does line up with, I believe, if I remember correctly, when Leonard Nimoy shows up. On that show.
Yeah. He does show up on that show.
That's a positive.
Walternate. It's Walternate.
Walternate. Yeah,
so they're like, until Folivia and Walternate. I was like, this is really fun to like absorb some other show's DNA. Yeah, so anyway.
Oh, man. If only there was a time in Lost, the Storm the Lost Rewatch podcast, we could just suddenly do one episode of Fringe, like we've constantly been doing a Fringe episode, and then back to the Lost universe. I would be up for that.
So that's everything that I have to say. I believe I nailed it all. So, Neil, what happened in these 2 hours of Lost?
Yes, in this 84-minute span of Lost.
84 minutes.
Yeah, that's pretty much. Through the Looking Glass, parts 1 and 2 were directed by Jack Bender. It was written by Carlton Cuse, Damon Lindelof, and it all aired together on May 23rd, 2007. This episode takes place on days 90 and 91 on the island. In flashes, a bearded Jack Shepherd struggles with depression, addiction, and a significant amount of guilt related to having been kicked out of Thailand, among other things. We watch as he has a tough conversation with Sarah, visits a mysterious funeral, and then meets up with Kate. We'll unpack that here in a minute. At the beach camp back on the island, things go awry for the husband squad as they try to take out the others. They take out a few of Ben's goons, but they're all ultimately captured, and Bernard very quickly gives up the entire plan to save Jin's life. Luckily, Hurley eventually comes roaring back in his van and saves the day. Sawyer and Juliet help as well. Elsewhere on the island, Ben takes off with Alex to stop Jack and his gang from reaching the radio tower. When they get there, he tries to convince Jack to give up his quest to contact Naomi's boat, but it goes very poorly. The good news is that Alex is reunited with her mother, and they bond over tying a very bloody Ben to a tree. Back at the Dharma gravesite, John Locke awakens, tries to put an end to his journey, but is interrupted by very tall and dry Walt, who reminds him that he has work to do. Work like showing up to the radio tower and throwing a knife into Naomi's back, just as she's about to make a phone call. Unfortunately for John, it doesn't stop Jack from making contact with the freighter, but it does potentially rid us of Naomi's terrible wig. Underwater, in the Looking Glass station, Charlie is interrogated by Bonnie and Greta. They don't get very far before Desmond and Mikhail join the party, and not long after that, Mikhail takes out Ben's women, and even though Desmond shoots him in the chest with a harpoon, he swims back outside and blows a hole in the side of the station, ultimately sealing Charlie's fate. Despite all of that, Charlie uses his Sharpie to communicate to Des that it's not Penny's boat. It all ends with the reveal that Jack's flashback is really a flash forward, and we have to go back.
Yay, we made it.
This is the most dramatic, reenactment stuff of the episode, Neil.
Fun fact about this episode, Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse both appear in this episode in voice form. Lindelof voiced the captain at the beginning, apologizing for turbulence on the PA, and Carlton Cuse voices the off-screen news reporter on Action 8 News, describing the car crash that Jack definitely caused. This week's calm question: if you received a golden pass from an airline after a horrific crash and 3 months stranded on an island of mystery, would you ever fly again? And if so, where would you go first? I'm very curious to hear if you would ever fly again. Let's start with Joanna.
0% never flying again. maybe I would take a long, slow boat ride to the other continents, but it's like train time for me.
All right.
Yeah.
Dave, are you jumping back on a plane anytime soon?
Let's see. What would have happened to me? I would have crash landed, been useless, built my monkey hotel, gotten off. I'd gotten like a golden pass. Maybe my solution would be I would only fly over land, because then if I'm going down, I'm like going down. I'm not getting back up.
I feel like I have, and this might actually be surprising, given that you guys know me. I have this thing where, like, if I do something and I find, and I live through it, I guess, and I find out that it's survivable, it makes me feel better, and maybe I would do it. So if I were to actually survive a horrific plane crash, and then get rescued and all that, honestly, I'd probably
be like,
use that.
I'm a golden god. Give me my golden pass.
I would not be using it in the extremely depressing way that Jack is using it. I would use it to like go visit places, you know, like go spend like one day in a city somewhere internationally and then just fly back home. Cause I'm assuming with this golden pass, he could just jump on a plane wherever he wants. And that kind of sounds fun. And this might also be a result of having been stuck inside all year.
That's a good point. Right now, a golden pass sounds fantastic outside of the idea that there would probably be other people on the flight, but I would deal with it. At this point, I've survived the Island of Mystery and the weird plague on that island.
And at that point,
you know,
I would
existed.
Be convincing Oceanic to just give me my own plane. This feels like a very 2007 idea, the fact that he's only getting a golden pass. I'm sorry, it's 2020. I want a whole plane.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe they had to cover it up. We don't. Anyway, let's talk about Jack and our new turn in the entire format of Lost, which I am sure for our calm viewers who did manage to make it through this episode, catching on at various points, but maybe not until the end, means that this episode is probably seems very rewatchable your first time through. For me, at least, the kind of viewer that I am, I would be like, oh my, I got to go back and watch the Jack flashes to try to figure out if they were tipping their hand. And then, you know, you run across things like Kate says, like, I got to get back to him. Or like Jack's like talking about his dad, who at that point is like dead. And all these things come up that are like new mysteries, not the, like the very most of which is the mysterious coffin that this all rotates around. And I assure you that there is tons of, internet backlog of people spending weeks between I think months, actually. I think it was like 8 or 9 months in between the end of season 3 and the beginning of season 4 tearing into the Jack flash forward. Is there anything that really stood out to you guys this time around about how they either use Jack as a character up through season 3 or specifically in this episode as a depressing misdirect to a really cool story turn?
Well, we talked about this in the storm around Stranger in a Strange Land and also the season premiere. Those are the only other two Jack episodes in the season. And in both those episodes, he is a huge asshole abusing substances, at least in Stranger in a Strange Land. I can't remember if when he decides to stalk Sarah and break up an AA meeting, he is drunk at the time. but, you know, basically, like, we saw Jack behaving badly all season in flashback, which, you know, beautifully lays the groundwork for us to buy that this is something that Jack would have done before the island. So I like that for it. And I would say, and I have to say, I just want to shout out Matthew Fox in this episode. Matthew Fox is by all accounts a bad human being. And we have a lot of, I think, genuinely legitimate criticisms of Jack as a character. That being said, Matthew Fox's performance in this episode, I think, is just both on island and off, really, 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 really good stuff. So
I think even in bad Jack episodes, usually Matthew Fox is, you know,
yeah,
recognizing of the hurdle he has to clear and usually clears it pretty well.
He's a good actor. He might be a bad dude, but yeah, he's a good actor. And we did get, I didn't read it, but we did get an email of someone, this is a familiar refrain, someone feels like we're being a little too hard on Jack in general. I don't think so, but I will say, I feel like this is a real turning point for the Jack character and our understanding of him this episode. I think seeing him like at I mean, I think it's fair to say this is a rock bottom place for Jack post-Island. I think that makes me interested in the momentum of his character. That's me. No one has to agree with me. And as far as like a misdirect, I mean, you asked about the use of Jack in this season, but I will say as far as a misdirect in the flashback, I think the Christian Shepherd stuff is a little cheap. I think the two like cleverest misdirects are him rescuing, quote unquote, rescuing the woman on the bridge, which makes him a hero. So when people refer to him as like a famous hero, it's not famous hero survivor of a plane crash. It's famous hero rescued a
guy
rescued
a woman from a crash he probably caused.
And someone says, in the episode, hero twice over. And you won't catch that the first time, but that's, you know, it's a plane crash survivor, bridge hero, quote unquote. And then the other one is the use of Sarah, which I think is really effective in this episode, that she would still be his emergency contact post crash just because he like didn't bother. Like, how often do we update our emergency contacts? You know what I mean?
especially not post island. Like post island, you're probably right. Can have a different perspective on what life means and whatnot.
So I think that's a good use of Julie Bowen, because it's just sort of like anytime we see Julie Bowen, we're like safely feel like we're in a Jack flashback. And so I think that's like a really clever misdirect in the episode. So yeah, that's my answer. Neil?
Nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mostly agree. I really do. One of the things I was trying to pay attention to on the subsequent rewatches, which was, you know, Saturday when we watched it with the Slack, and then again today before we started recording, and there's a pretty good performance happening from James Legere, who plays the new doctor, the new head of surgery at the hospital. And just like, if you watch his face in that hallway scene where Jack is clearly out of control and he's like, let's go up to get my father right now out of his office. And this guy is just like this horrified look, like, does he not realize that his father's like been dead for a long time? Or and it's a really good, just subtle performance of, and what it makes me wonder, and this is the question I would have for that actor, is like, how much did they tell that actor? Because I think we were talking before about how they were very secretive. They try to be very secretive about the script around this flash forward and what it meant, and especially the last scene with Kate. But I wonder if there's just this like knowing horror in this one character who actually would know what's going on with Jack. Like, he would know the story of Jack. And
wait. Really, this was good. Directed by Jack Bender? Yeah, Jack Bender totally walked up to the guy and whispered in his ear, "His dad's dead." And there's nothing you could do about it.
Right. Nothing in the script. He's just right on set. His dad's dead.
Thank you, Joanna, for getting the call back.
Well, that's a David. It was a David Nutter quote, but it's still like something that Jack Bender would do. Mm-hmm.
A good old Game of Thrones director.
Good old Nutter Bender. Emotional manipulation directing.
I really like that they were able to reframe Jack at the end of the third season, which is, you know, it's not exactly the midpoint, but it feels like a very midpoint of the series. And this idea that they take Jack, who is a character that, if you're growing tired of Jack on the island, that feels by design at this point, almost. And they reframe it as, to make him more interesting. So now there's tons of questions, you know. And I guess one of the other things I forgot about this episode before we watched it is how, like, there's like things are being pulled out of the mystery box as we go along in season three. And then the finale comes along and it's just like somebody just kicks the mystery box over and a bunch of mysteries spill out. And there's a ton of questions about Jack. How did he get off the island? You know, who else got off the island? How long have they been off the island? All kinds.
Why does he care that someone's dead?
Right, who's in the box?
Who's in the box?
You know, what is Jack ultimately so depressed about? Why does he want to go back? You know, so
what are they lying about?
Right, what are they lying about? Mm-hmm. Which seems like everybody's lying to somebody around here. So yeah, I just think it's one of the more brilliant things they do in Lost to take a character that we're growing tired of and be like, oh, now I care at least about what you know, the details are that led him to this place. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of the flash forwards.
Yeah.
I know not everybody is a big fan of when they switch to flash forwards, but
I think
it's a great choice.
It's interesting because, like, it really ramps up the mystery box element. Like, there was already a mystery box element of the show of, oh, you know, like, what's in the hatch, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. What's the, we still don't know what's going on with the smoke monster Foley. Who are the others, blah, blah. Like, you know, it's always been chasing that. But I think it leans really hard into that push-pull in season four. And we'll get there as we talk about season four. But, like, you know, you're left with the question right now of, like, did anyone else get off the island with Jack and Kate? And if so, how did they get off the island? And how did Jack and Kate get off the island? And, like, what's going on? And who's in the box?
And why aren't they happy? That's the other thing.
And, like, why did Jack think the beard was a look?
No one looks sadder or more depressed. No pairing is sadder than that last scene where it's Kate and Jack. And it's just like, what the hell happened? You know?
There was, I think there's, like, the thing about the show that works narratively that they sort of clicked into with Walkabout in season one is, like, being able to tell character stories and mystery stories in this format of being able to intercut with, like, somebody's flashback and what was happening on island. And then they exhausted that, and where some shows would, like, just completely retool and allow the show to be something else. And, you know, it is significantly different, but I think it's still the same change. The change they made is relying on the same principle, which is you give us a peek of where a character ends up and we don't know how they got there. And that becomes the character-based mystery. That's going to become our new fuel for Lost, I think, moving forward, at least for the first couple of episodes of season four. After that, you guys are going to have to stay tuned to see what happens. But I don't think it does a really good job of not violating the engine that made the show works, but then also does what Neil's talking about, which is, like, establish a whole bunch of mysteries off the island. Like, we've had an island of mystery so much that we call it our jungle of mystery moments in our corners. But now they've moved the source of the mystery completely off island and into the future, allowing this buffer of an unknown period of time, enough to grow a beard at least, between what we saw, which is apparently them getting rescued, and Jack insisting that they have to go back. Which is just great. It's a great way of
so
structuring
good.
Your story.
It, in our podcast intro since the very beginning. That one.
Yeah, we had to. It's been. Yeah, as I said in our chat, our Patreon Slack. It's hard to promote a Lost rewatch podcast for people who haven't seen Lost before, and try to not lean on "we have to go back" because it's a perfect thing for a rewatch. It's our slogan now. We have to go back. Mm-hmm. We had season two gave us "we have to watch that again." So thanks, Dharma Initiative. But we'll have to see what surprises does season four give us. It's going to be fun. We know the answer. All right, guys. Do we have any lingering questions about our flash forward with Jack? No, good.
Well, yes, oh. Yes.
Yes, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I guess we have lingering questions. Do we have any questions that we need to answer here? I guess I will answer one question by jumping slightly ahead to one of our corners. Each week we decide where Libby is in our alternate story. Was flashbacks. Now it's flash forward. So where's Libby? She's probably in that casket. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, they dug her up when they left the island. She was the mm-hmm. only one that they dug up, and they took her body.
And that little piece in the paper was like, you know, dug up remains of mystery Shepherd Island, you know, finally delivered to funeral home. And no one shows up, and Jack's just torn up about it.
I guess Dave's long gone at this point.
Dave's long gone. Yeah, yeah, all the Daves. Man, all the Daves really let Libby down at that point. All right, Joanna, you wanna chat with Jen for a little bit?
Well, really quickly, I want to bring back an old favorite that we sort of wait. Did we already mention the funeral parlor anagram?
No. Let's do a funeral parlor anagram check-in. Those turkey lost writers.
Okay, Hofstrawler, I believe, is the name of the funeral parlor, which is an anagram of flash forward. So that's one thing.
That's clever.
And then the other thing is that, no, that's not a... Okay, someone said that they thought Jack's Ford Bronco was an anachronism, or like a hint that we were in the future, but the Wikipedia seems to think not. So then I will just mention that the phone that Jack uses, which is a Motorola Razr, was mm-hmm. like a hint to people because it didn't come out till 2006. And at the time, I think... Like, right now, we see a Motorola Razr and we're like, sure, the early mm-hmm. aughts, that seems about right, whatever. But I think at the time, people would have been like, wait a minute, that's... according to some people, at the time, that actually raised flags during the episode even. Of like, wait a minute, like, that's a 2000... That wouldn't be around in 2004, and they're usually pretty good about that sort of thing. So,
I mean,
it was a very famous phone.
Yes, I had one.
And it was like pre-iPhone, right?
Yeah.
iPhone did not come out until 2007. So, like, right. Yeah, it is true that like people would have remembered, because this aired in 2007. So people would have been like, hey, didn't that phone just come out a year ago?
Right, exactly.
Well, also, like Lost, if you go to, you know, Lostpedia, because you've watched the series, don't go there if you haven't watched the series. It's full of like bloopers with like, this newspaper from Claire's flashback has, you know, a 2006 date on it. So I'm sure there were eagle-eyed viewers who would absolutely notice that anachronism. And the interesting thing about like both the funeral parlor anagram and I think the phone is, even if you like, one of those cool things about you know, watching something live is, even if you did figure it out, it wasn't like there was a week in between that you could message board. It's like that, you know, happened during the episode, and
right.
then it was like, flash forward, and then it was something cool to find in the 9 months in between that and new episodes of Lost. So I'm sure iTunes got its fill of this purchase, and the old TiVo, this is back in the TiVo days, that was a machine we used to use to record television. Not unlike a Motorola Razr.
Boop, boop.
Yep. Indeed.
All right, now I want to talk to Jen.
Do it.
We are thrilled to welcome on the podcast for the first time, Vulture TV critic, my a personal hero of mine, Jen Chaney, is here. Hello, Jen. How are you?
I'm good. I'm so happy to be here.
Oh, I'm so happy you're here. I was first alerted to your Lost know-how and fandom when the anniversary of the series finale came around, and you were doing all this great stuff for Vulture. But can you zoom back and just sort of tell me about your larger relationship with Lost as a TV show?
Very much so. This is the first TV show that I ever recapped. When I was working at the Washington Post, myself and my friend and colleague Liz Kelly would write about it every week, and it was really, I mean, this is going to sound funny, but it was a kind of eye-opening experience from a journalistic standpoint, in that I had never worked on something where that it was getting so much pickup and there was so much interest. And then to the point where it would go back, like it would circle around to, you know, Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse, and like they would know about it. That was kind of a crazy experience for me. But I also just, you know, personally really loved the show and have just really warm feelings about it because of that experience, and just because of all the, you know, all the reasons I think that it means a lot to a lot of people because of the subject matter it deals with.
What about the subject matter do you feel like really connected with people?
I mean, there's the mystery element, but I think, you know, this whole, the way it kind of dealt with spirituality, and not in strictly religious terms, but mm-hmm. just, you know, what, I feel like it's a really existential show, asking you what is the meaning of life? What is important in life? Kind of questions. And it was a show that my mother really, really loved. And she passed away like a couple years after it ended. And was always worried, like, I hope I live to see the end of the show.
No. Yeah.
Which she did.
She did. Yeah.
But so it's like, you know, obviously the people who you were watching it with and the emails I would get from people, like, and I got one recently from someone like, here's a theory of Lost I have. And it's like 5 pages of all the fascinating stuff. And you're like, oh, wow. Okay. So just, I love the way that it made people really think and ponder philosophical issues in ways that, you know, most TV shows do not.
And I definitely want to get into that because you're right that it's not always, you know, strictly religious spirituality. But Charlie, as a character who is religious, is an interesting figure to think about at the end of his life here. So mm-hmm. Before we get into that, though, I wanted to ask you, guys, a little bit more about Lost as a cultural phenomenon at the dawn of this kind of readership engagement or viewership engagement, because this is like the dawn of real like message board obsessiveness and like that. I mean, I think the X-Files definitely, you know, pinged that in a slightly earlier phase of it, but I don't know. This to me feels like the beginning of modern fandom, the way that we see it now with shows like Mr. Robot or Westworld, the speculation, the theory, the like communal online aspect of it.
100%. I mean, this, you're right that I think on a smaller scale, like shows like The X-Files were tapping into that, but this was such a mainstream popular show, and it just hit right at that moment when social media was really taking off and places like Reddit were becoming, you know, more of a place to communicate with people. And it is I call it the quintessential mystery box TV show, to borrow a J.J. Abrams phrase. Mm-hmm. And I think Westworld and so many other shows that have come since are operating on that same level where people just want to dig in and dissect everything that's in every frame of the episodes. But I will say, I mean, not that people weren't negative about Lost, especially toward the end, but I don't know if you agree with me, but I felt like there was a real niceness to the fandom that doesn't exist quite as much as it used to. Like, you know, in the blogs that Liz and I would do in the recaps, there were people that, you know, the people who came to comment were like a little family, and we had like a happy hour for the finale, and it was like all these people like, oh, I know you. Like, I mean, and people came in costume. they filmed a video of it that unfortunately I think the internet has deleted from existence, but of people talking about the finale. It was before it had aired, obviously, and just in tears. Like, it was, there was a real like emotional kind of stronghold that the show had on people, and I think people were not shy about expressing that and sharing that with people. And it was really nice.
Yeah, I think you still see that, but rarely around these like big mystery hour-long shows. I think you see that around like Schitt's Creek fandom or something, right. You know what I mean? Something like or a Michael Schur show where people are just here for like a good time and to feel like nice and warm and fuzzy, and the internet has sort of like as a whole moved away from that kind of community building, and it becomes more, a lot of fandoms become a lot more like us versus them. But I think you're right at the time that like if you were invested enough to care about Lost week to week and theories and all that sort of stuff, at that time on the internet, you know, I didn't have the same experience with the Lost fandom, but I was like on the Buffy boards, and it was just like, it was very much that on the Buffy boards, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
you're just like, you're there because you love it. And then I think only a little bit later in the internet's life cycle, it became, or if you hate it, also hang out and hate watch and yell at people and stuff like that. So,
right. And again, I mean, people did that with Lost, like I said, especially toward the end, but I feel like a lot of the kind of mystery box type shows now, Westworld being to me the prime example, they're all about that intellectual pursuit of what does this all mean without the heart aspect of it. And I think mm-hmm. Lost really had both of those things going for it in equal measure.
I think that's right. I think that's exactly right. So you mentioned to me before we started recording that you wanted to talk specifically about the opening of this episode. And so I want to hear your thoughts on the opening of what I consider to be, and Lost was always strong with its season finales, but I think this is the strongest, other than the series finale, which has its own power for different reasons. But like this, I think is widely considered to be one of the best season finales
finales ever, but definitely for Lost. So take us through the opening, Jen.
Yeah, I think it's a top five episode of the series easily. And like you said, a all-timer for season finales. But, you know, we talk a lot about the ending of this episode and not as much about the opening, which, you know, you see Jack Shepard. He's in a car. He's not looking so hot. Yeah. He calls somebody on the phone. He seems upset. He's looking at what appears to be a newspaper clipping. We don't know what it says. And he just stops the car, gets out, and climbs up on a bridge and looks like he's going to jump when he hears a commotion behind him. And we later learn that there was a car accident. And of course, Jack being Jack has run to save the people who were injured in the accident. And first of all, the opening reminds me a little bit of It's a Wonderful Life, of that moment when George Bailey is standing on the bridge and contemplating whether he should jump or not. And of course, he gets saved by Clarence. But this is a divine intervention of a different sort. And it's interesting within the broader scope of the episode. Is it okay to talk a little bit, to relate this to the ending of this episode?
Oh, of course. Yeah. Okay. Go for it. Yeah.
In that we later learn that Jack, which I love the entire concept of this because it's so heartbreaking, has been using his golden ticket to fly Oceanic every Friday night to Singapore or Australia or whatever faraway location in the hope that it will crash and he'll get back on the island again and can, you know, redo the things that he felt he didn't do correctly.
Yeah.
And in this opening, you know, it's like God has a sense of humor, like, oh, you want an accident? Here you go. Here's an accident, not an airplane, but
right.
What are you going to do? But it forces him to be a hero, but in a different, in the context that he doesn't want. Yeah. And I think that's also really a heartbreaking concept.
That's fascinating. I hadn't thought about that because if my holiday memory serves me correctly, isn't Jimmy Stewart saved by Clarence because Clarence throws himself in the water and so Jimmy Stewart has to save him? And
correct.
Like that sort of, you know,
yes,
so yeah,
right.
So like, let's trigger the hero complex in you, George Bailey. That's interesting. Oh, fascinating. Yeah, it's a really interesting opener. And it's also, it reminds me of, you know, we were just talking about Greatest Hits last week, which, you know, really probably this should have been a three-part finale, and Lost has done three-part finales before, but I always think of Greatest Hits as like one of a series of this because it does so much to lay track for Charlie. But it's also, when you start Greatest Hits, you start with a flashback of Charlie and his brother are arguing about whether or not Charlie's going to quit the band. And you sort of heave this heavy sigh because you're like, another Charlie flashback where they're arguing about the band. We've seen this before. What are you guys doing? And then all of a sudden you realize that episode's doing something really different and great with flashbacks. And then similarly at the end of this, you know, you start this and you're like, oh great, we've already seen Jack rock bottom in, you know, with Biling in Stranger to Strangeland. We've seen Jack rock bottom at the beginning of this season as he's like stalking his ex-wife Sarah. So do we really really want to watch Jack rock bottom again? And then you know, it's not until later that you realize you're seeing something different. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. I like to pretend that Stranger in a Strange Land doesn't exist. So it feels less redundant for me if I do it that way.
But it's like, it's a redundancy that's playing with your expectations. Like, I feel like they're, you know, they've been very open, Carlton and Damon, about the fact that they knew in season three that they were running out of gas in their traditional flashback structure. And so they knew they had to like figure out something else to do, which they, you know, they really set the reset in this episode. But I don't know how intentional it is, but it feels like the opening of this and the opening of Greatest Hits are playing with our like, you know, fatigue expectations, only to serve up something really surprising in the end.
Yeah, absolutely. And if memory serves, you know, this was the point where there was a writer's strike earlier in the same season, and Damon and Carlton were negotiating with ABC about, you know, when are we going to end this thing? And ABC wanted to go for like 10 seasons or something. And they were like, no, let's maybe do slightly less than that. But that was the point at which they could start to see like, okay, we're going to have an end point. And I think that really informs what this episode is about and the direction that it goes in. And I think that's part of the reason it's so thrilling, is that to have that knowledge, I'm sure, made them exhale a little bit when they were writing this.
Right. And just sort of like be like, okay, now we can get into this other thing that we want to do. And if we have an idea of a shape of an ending, let's start, instead of spinning our wheels on the beach, let's start laying our track towards that. And that gives the whole show a lot more tension and momentum than it had, at least, you know, in the weaker parts of season 2 and 3. So it's, you know, it's really exciting. You mentioned also before we started recording that you want to talk about the way in which this episode withholds information. I mean, it's like a really tricky thing to pull off. And once you know the twist at the end of this episode, that it's a flash forward, as we call it, not a flashback, you know, you go back and there may be some like a few little cheats here and there, but like, what do you think of the way that they laid this? I don't want to call it a trap because it doesn't seem like, it doesn't seem cheap to me, but they laid this twist for viewers.
Well, I mean, there's the withholding of where, I mean, we just assume first time watching this, that what we're watching is a flashback, because that's always been the way the show has done before. So that is withheld from you until the very final scene. But even just little details are withheld. As I was talking about before, that newspaper clipping, we have no idea what it says. Initially, we don't know who he's called on the phone. We infer later that it was Kate. And then, of course, a big thing is that he goes to the funeral home and someone's dead, but we don't know who it is. And we're not going to find out until the next season. Right. That's a huge, huge thing to withhold from people. And I just think they do such a good job of, like, I mean, even just the idea of whatever he was reading in the newspaper clipping, then all these other things start to happen and it's easy to forget about that until they finally come back to it. And you're like, oh, wait, yeah, that's important. I just think they do such a great job of just, you know, just reeling you in and in a very meticulous and precise way with what they will tell you and what they won't, and knowing exactly when the moment is to finally explain what's happening.
It'll be interesting to see if our listeners who are watching for the first time are going to be hit with the same level of surprise, because I mean, it's fine if they're not. I think the episode still stands up if you're not, but it's so hard many years later when it's known that weird hijinks with time is something that Lost does. The "we have to go back" line is so famous, you know, the GIF is so famous. And so I think, you know, there's probably like seeds of suspicion in our viewers' minds as they're watching this episode. But like, you know, for me, my memory is that until Kate steps out of the shadow with her blowout and her lip gloss, and then you're like, what's happening? That was my experience watching this episode live.
Well, I remember watching it and I was just like, wait, what? Like, I had to process it for a couple seconds before I fully grasped what they had just done.
Yeah.
Because it was so unexpected. That makes me sad that you're right. I'm sure most people watching it now, even if they've never seen it, have some inkling of what might be happening. And it makes me sad that people can't have that moment of surprise that those of us who saw it when it first aired have, because it was such a mind-blowing thing.
Yeah, it was a big moment. And the only, I mean, I guess the only thing that I consider like maybe a little bit of a cheat, but they get away with it because Jack is out of his mind on drugs for, you know, the duration of the flash forward. But the constant invocation of Christian Shepherd, where he's like, get my dad down here. And you're like, and that's, you know, if you're watching and you're starting to question when it is, you're like, oh, Christian Shepherd. Well, it must be. Of course, this is a flashback. Christian Shepherd is deceased. That's the only thing that on rewatch, once you know the revelation, you're like, all right, that's a little it's a little bit of a cheat there. You know,
well, I think in the scene where he's trying to get his refills, like, I took that as he's probably just writing down Christian Shepherd.
Right.
Maybe. But yeah, the scene where he's like, get my dad down here and see which one of us is more drunk. Yeah, I don't know. I was willing to let that slide also. Because
totally.
I just think I think he's good. Imagine how you would be if you were flying to Singapore once a week, having a drink and then getting back on the plane. Like, you would have no sense of time. You'd feel like we do now in 2020.
even without the like prescription, you know, pills, I think, yeah, my brain would be scrambled eggs for sure. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. And it's like, it's funny that you mentioned, you know, you pretend that Stranger in a Strange Land doesn't exist, because we were talking to Josh Wigler from The Hollywood Reporter about that episode. And he's like, here's my defense of Stranger in a Strange Land. I'm like, hit me with your Stranger in a Strange Land defense. And he's like, without seeing Jack so aggro and drunk in that episode, you need that to like sort of lull you into that mode of Jack so that you don't get suspicious about Through the Looking Glass. And I was like, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way, that they were sort of like through in the only other two Jack episodes in the season, it's him wildly out of control in the past. And right. So that when they serve you him wildly out of control in the future, you know, you're like, ah, well, same as it ever was, just with a beard this time, you know, sort of thing.
Yeah. I mean, that's a fair point to make. I don't know if it totally convinces me, but it's a fair point to make.
They could have done a better job of it.
That's I think they would say do. The same thing.
Yeah, they definitely would. All right, and then I mean, like, I am very curious about this idea of fate and spirituality and faith, and how they all sort of collide with Charlie Pace in this episode. You know, Damon, having watched what Damon did with The Leftovers and with Watchmen, this idea of his preoccupation with spirituality and God and godlike figures and stuff like that has been really, you know, I'm an atheist, but I find his ongoing quest to answer those questions for himself, or at least explore them, really endlessly fascinating. Mm-hmm. And so, and I really like how it centers on Charlie in this episode. You know, it's easy to forget that Charlie Pace was an altar boy sometimes, but, you know, the fact that as he dies, he crosses himself and stuff like that, you know, makes sure that you don't forget in this context. So, yeah, I'm just wondering what your Charlie Pace faith and spirituality thoughts were.
Well, I mean, there's two things going on kind of counterintuitively in this. One is that, you know, he clearly believes Desmond that he's fated to go to that station and do all the things that Desmond has kind of foreseen in his visions. But he also, at the same time, feels like he can thwart it. It won't really totally happen. He won't die, because like when he first gets to the station, he's like, "Woo, I'm not dead," and it's like, "Well, you just got there." so I feel like there's that, and I feel like this is a present in a lot of Damon's work. This idea that there is fate on some level, but there's also free will, and it's unclear where one ends and the other begins.
Right.
But free will exists enough that people feel like they have a destiny, but they can somehow alter the destiny to work in their favor in a way that isn't necessarily what they think is going to happen, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, it does. And you know, the stakes that are put on Charlie here, right? And this is this is like a late breaking way that Desmond's visions work, which is like an if then proposition, right? Like, mm-hmm. if you die, then Charlie and Aaron will be rescued. So, you know, you have to die. And so the stakes on that for Charlie, the chance to be a hero, you know, coming off the back of Greatest Hits, the chance to, like, you know, to play the hero, and not like necessarily a self-aggrandizing way, because he doesn't, like, that's the thing, is like, it's when Charlie says his goodbyes, not to dwell too much on Greatest Hits because I asked you to talk about these episodes, but like when he says his goodbyes to Claire, to Hurley, to whatever, he's not like bragging about this big heroic thing he's going to do. He downplays all of it. He hides it from them because he doesn't want to like upset them or have them try to stop him or stuff like that. But what it means right. then is it's not Charlie playing the hero in order to get like adulation. You know what I mean? This is definitely right. like, down in my core, I believe this is the morally right thing to do, and so I'm gonna do it, you know.
Right And in those goodbyes, and yeah, not to dwell too much on that episode, but in those goodbyes, he you know, there is an element of, just in case I never see you, I want to have this last interaction be a really positive one, but also I still think I will see you, and I'm hoping that's what happens.
Yeah.
You know,
Charlie, all right, now is the moment that we're going to talk about one of my new favorite questions, which is, did Charlie Pace have to die in this episode? The answer is emphatically no, but let's talk about it. Jen, what do you think?
No, I like, I don't know why I rewatched it again last night for the 8 millionth time or whatever. Yeah. And for some reason on this watch, it really upset me more than I think it ever has before. I'm like, wait a second. Like, you know,
close it from the other side of the door, Charlie.
Close it from the other freaking side.
Yeah.
And also, or even if he didn't close it, I feel like he and Desmond would have had enough time to run and jump out of the Looking Glass station.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't, like, going to flood the entire station in, like, 2 seconds.
Well, I think, okay, so my best interpretation of this is that, well, I mean, first of all, panic brain, sure. Okay, I'll give you that, yeah. Charlotte. Like, panic brain with the thought of, like, I'm supposed to drown in this room, like, sort of on his mind. Like, right. I can understand how that would just sort of be like, okay, I got to do this. But also, like, I think my best interpretation of this is that, you know, Charlie is worried that if Desmond... you know, like, because Desmond does see that it's Penny on the monitor. And so if Desmond sees that Penny's on the monitor, nothing is going to stop him from staying in that room and talking to her or something like that. And that then Desmond's True. Life would be in danger. And I'm like, because like, how is Charlie going to get him to dive into the moon pool if Penny's on the TV? So like, I guess, but still, no, Charlie, you know, Jack did not have to die at the end of Titanic and Charlie Pace did not have to die in this episode.
There's
it's iconic.
There's plenty of room on the door.
Know? Yes. There's plenty of room on the door and you could have closed that, Looking Glass hatch door from the outside, my friend.
Well, let me think. Well, now that you're saying that, like, there's a huge force of water coming through. I don't know how difficult it would have been to actually, for the two of them to close it in light of that. But I still think they could have, even if they couldn't close the door from the other side, they could have run and, like you said, jumped in the moon pool and been on their way.
Yeah. So,
I mean, how fast can it flood if there's a pool in the middle of it?
It's a good question, right? Yeah, exactly. I don't know what fail safes there were. I don't know if it like starts a self-destruct sequence. I couldn't tell you, but, it seems in the end. And it's also, were you an Alias, watcher, an Alias fan?
I should have been. I was not. Okay.
It's just funny because it's not funny, huh? But like, I will never forget the end of season one of Alias because Michael Vartan's character Vaughn like does the same thing where he like water's coming and Jennifer Garner's running in front of him and she somehow gets way in front of him, no reason that she does, and then the door closes and then he drowns through like a porthole as they're like touching hands on either side of the glass. And I'm like, all right, this is a real not Penny's boat moment for Alias. And I'll never forget it because I was like too young and impressionable. I was like, is Vaughn ever coming back? I didn't understand how like worked at the time. but I think what's significant about this though is that, you know, something that I've been thinking about a lot is like, I don't think there's a TV show now that would telegraph a death the way that Charlie's death is telegraphed. They're telling you all season he's going to die. I don't think there's a TV show now that would telegraph a death that way and then actually kill the character. I feel like the only reason they telegraph deaths like that is so that, you know, there could be like a last minute reversal, or they like to surprise you. And that, you know, I blame Game of Thrones a lot for that in terms of like, the Ned Stark death and the Red Wedding and stuff like that just like convinced a lot of TV makers that like a death has to be a shock in order for it to be effective, which is not, I don't think that's true.
Right.
Like I think about The Walking Dead. I don't know if you were a Walking Dead watcher at all, but like there was all that like monkey business around the character of Glenn dying, Steven Yeun's character, because like, it was known in the comics that he would, and the show was just sort of like, yeah, but maybe not, guys. You don't know. And they like sort of just pulled all of these tricks in order to try to keep that a surprise. When I'm like, it's not surprise. It doesn't have to be a surprise. And so Lost is telling us all season Charlie's gonna die. And then he dies. And it's still, even if he didn't have to, we both agree, right. It's still emotional in the execution of it.
Right. And let's be honest, that's really the reason to do it, to have that moment, to have that imagery of him making that last sacrifice and putting his palm with Not Penny's boat on the window. That's really the reason to do it, because it just has such emotional impact to see that. But, you know, I also just, again, for people who are watching this now, in light of all the shows you just mentioned, it's hard for them, I think, to grasp like how unusual it was to see television like this at the time, especially on a broadcast network. I think it's still unusual on a broadcast network, at least to be done as well as this is done, where the bad thing happens. You know, I mean, this is a show that originally the pilot was going to kill Jack. He was going to die in the first episode.
Right. Yeah.
And was the fact that certain characters did die like early on that you would think, oh, well, that person's a regular. They're not going to kill that person. Nope. The rules are torn up now. So we'll just do whatever we feel is right. And so, you would think that they would save him, but they don't. And I think that's, with all due respect to Dominic Monaghan, who I think is great, like it's a testament to the show's value that they would take those kind of risks.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, I think they knew this isn't the first character that they've talked about how they kind of rushed through Charlie's backstory and then just ran out of gas on that character. And we're just like, we don't know what to do with him. And it's not the first time they've done that. You know what I mean? They didn't really know what to do with Shannon and Boone. So they were like, all right, incest brother and sister friends, Michael and Walt. That's a whole different thing in terms of like the kid growing too fast. So then they didn't know what to do with Harold Perrineau's character without Walt there. So bye to Michael. You know what I mean? So they've been snipping characters here and there, but like Charlie, just for a number of reasons, but I think maybe chief among them is the same reason Sean Bean's death is so shocking at Game of Thrones, which is the Lord of the Rings glow of it all, that Dom Monaghan was like kind of a big deal at the time. You know what I mean?
So. Yeah. I mean, I know that people now have different feelings about this, but I mean, my recollection and my feeling was that Charlie was a really, like, the fans really liked Charlie. Like, he was and especially because of his friendship with Hurley, like, anybody in Hurley's orbit, like, automatically gets some love. They would never dare to kill off Hurley, will they or will they not, for those of you who've never seen it? But I think that was also, I mean, and again, not to, like, people liked Walt and Michael and Shannon and Boone, yes, but we didn't really even get to know him for very long.
Right.
But I think there was more of an investment in Charlie as a character maybe than some of the other characters that had been killed off before.
No, you're completely right. I mean, like, I think it's true watching through now. I think a lot of people have a harder time with the Charlie archetype. He does not hold up super well on rewatches. He like steals Claire's baby at one point, and it's just really hard to come back from that, to be honest with you. But but at the time, you're absolutely right. He was a fan favorite. They thought he was like really cute and funny, and he is, and you know, at his best, he is. You know, and when he's sidekicking with Hurley, like it is the best. And so, this is, I mean, and it becomes the most iconic. I mean, it's so wild because this episode has two massively iconic Lost moments in it. Not Penny's Boat is huge, and then We Have to Go Back is equally huge. And the fact that they're both in the same episode is really wild. So
yeah.
I want to talk to you a little bit about just actually the broader, like, beyond the death stakes on Charlie and the big twist of the flash forward. This is also just like a really exciting episode for the tension and the stakes of the various you know, missions. You've got team radio signal, and you've got team beach, and you've got, you know, the husbands on the beach that you care about and their wives are out on the radio team. And, you've got walkie talkies, and you've got fake out deaths, and you've got, you know, a surprise return of John Locke and all this sort of stuff. So, you know, like what are the elements of this episode beyond all that just like make it feel like keep the momentum really strong as we go through it?
Well, one of the things I noticed rewatching it last night, and maybe in part it was because I was watching it on my laptop, but you know, this is a show that has, it's big and the scenery is always, you know, amazing, but so much of the way Jack Bender shot this is in like tight close-ups, like tight close-ups on people's faces, especially in those scenes where like Jack is on the walkie trying to negotiate and he and Ben are arguing, and that moment when they realize that the signal has opened up and that they're the freighter is going to come and get them. Like there's a lot of just tight close-ups and quick editing from person to person that just adds to that sense of like tension and momentum that's happening. And some other, like Hurley driving the bus, like being the hero there. That's a great moment.
So
and also I have to say, just no surprise, but the whole time I'm like, Michael Emerson is amazing. He's so,
so good.
Figure out where she is, Tom. Like he's just so dismissive of everyone. And sorry, I'm like rambling all over the place.
No, it's great.
Another, you know, great moment is when they're first kind of headed to the tower and Rose, I forget what Jack says, but Rose is like, if you say live together, die alone to me right now, I'm going to punch you in the face, which is, I don't know who wrote the line, but I would bet $1 million it was Damon.
Yeah. Damon's the king of like, let me skewer this thing that I previously wrote. Yeah, I mean, like, honestly, this show, what's interesting about season three that I didn't realize until this rewatch is that Rose and Bernard disappear for like the entire season. Mm-hmm. And then they show up right at the end here. And, you know, our affection for them has not diminished in their absence at all. And it just, you know, Rose is a character who's so good at cutting through Jack's bullshit. That I really, not that that's her only purpose, there's a lot of other things she does, but like she's so good at that. Mm-hmm. And Jack is in so much need of that I really wish they had used Rose better and more often on the show, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I feel like I could say that about almost every female character on the show.
Correct.
And we're back to talk about the other part that happened in Through the Looking Glass, parts 1 and 2, which is all the stuff on our island of mystery in our current timeline, days 90 and 91. We're on the island. Jack's going to enact his plan with some sharpshooters. People blow up. Here we have it sorted into three different categories, just like with stuff that happens on the beach, which is we got our three captives after the attack on the others. Goes pretty well. They blow up seven people.
I like to call them the husband squad.
The husband squad.
Bernard is Rose's husband. Jin, son's husband. Saeed, everyone's husband.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Everyone's very good husband. Then we have the field squad, which is the rest of the beach survivors who follow Jack into the jungle to get to the radio tower. So when Charlie, in our final location down at the Looking Glass, turns off the jamming signal, they could use Naomi's satellite phone to contact her freighter, which is somewhere offshore of the island within helicopter range, and it will get them all rescued. Joanna, there's a bunch of payoffs this week on the beach, and you have a return of Joanna's best payoff poll.
Yeah, I mean, this band's the whole episode, but I ran this last week and I want to run it again this week.
Now the Sharpie has a stronger
You've got
footing.
You've got four candidates here. Choppy is one of them, right? So the Sharpie payoff, right? Mm-hmm. And then the number two is from the field section, and it is the Alex and Russo reunion. Right?
Ooh, awesome. Yeah.
And then we've got two from the beach, and it is, of course, the VW bus from Trisha Tanaka is Dead, and then Sawyer
this
killing
is for
Tom.
Taking the boy.
Say this is for taking the kid off the raft. So Sawyer's vengeance for Walt, the return of the VW bus, Charlie's choppy, or Alex and Russo. Dang, those casting people did a really good job with those actresses. Which is your pick, Neil?
I'm taking Alex and Russo for the exact reason you mentioned, which is amazing casting. And I think we have to constantly come back to how great the casting is on this show, other than the accent stuff. Because they nailed it in the pilot when they cast the main cast, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then this casting of mother and daughter is incredible. And I just love the small detail that the first words Rousseau says to her daughter after 16 years is, "Will you help me tie him up?" Speaking about Ben. And that's just so
delicious. So good. Yeah. Dave?
I'm going to surprise even myself and take Sawyer Kills Friendly, just because of what it says about the season and both of those characters, where it's like when Friendly takes Walt, absolutely hate Friendly. Now, it's not that we don't hate Friendly, but he's one of the others I don't mind in terms of we've met some others that are actually pretty straight up evil as far as the story is concerned. I'm sorry, I'm going to say evil instead of bad antagonist. Whatever you want to say, there are some others who I do not like, and the narrative wants me not to like them.
Was definitely evil. That guy
that Ryan
so
guy, Pickett before him. There's a flavor of others that is not my favorite flavor of the Neapolitan. And I'm going to say that Sawyer has also become like this weird vengeance machine where he hasn't totally dealt with the, you know, murder that was the apex of his existence, really. And it sort of makes him mishandle his, I think, feelings for Kate. So to see him get like to become this like tool of vengeance and to see Friendly's full arc where I kind of like him. But Sawyer reminds me. He took Waltz and sort of kicked all this off, is a great payoff moment of two moments that I didn't necessarily think were going to pay off. So great.
For me, it has to be a VW van because like Trisha Tanaka's Dead is such a good episode of the season just for the pure joy of it. But the fact that the VW van like pays off in Man Behind the Curtain and then pays off again in this episode retroactively makes Trisha Tanaka's Dead not just like a fun quote unquote filler episode or whatever, but just like a vitally important to the series. And like, you know, Hurley comes tearing out of the jungle in a VW van, which like under most circumstances we would be like, this is ridiculous and beggars belief and stuff like that. But like, no, I mean, it's completely satisfying because you're just like, yes, Hurley had this tool at his disposal. We know he did. So, yeah, VW van all the way for sure.
And I love the Sawyer moment where he goes up and he closes the door on him and he's like, stay inside, hero.
Oh, he says, I thought he said Hugo. Does he say hero?
I thought he says hero.
Oh, it's nicer for him to say hero because he sounds a little exasperated when he says it. And I'm like, he just saved you, man. Like, don't talk down. He just fully murked a dude with a van, by the way. R.I.P. not P. I don't like you, Ryan, but rest in restlessness, Ryan.
Sand.
You're dead
rest
now.
In sand.
Yeah, rest in sand.
Rest in your communal dharma grave.
Yeah, so
everything that happens to Hurley in this episode is
Hurley's now a murderer. Is the point? It's easy to miss because like three big murders happen right in a row, right? Like Saeed does his thing, and Sawyer does his thing, and Hurley. It seems more like a comedy murder.
It's a fun, heroic murder.
Well,
especially comparison to the other two. Saeed's complete flipping / snapping somebody's neck with his ankles, because as we know, he's very good.
Oh, he's got the most amazing calves.
And for a lot of people in our live watch, gave Bernard a little bit of flack when he was unable to lie at all to the others about the plan to go to the radio tower. But it seems like everyone on the beach sort of ended up alive. So maybe Bernard speaking out of turn is just, you got to trust Bernard sometimes. You just got to charge forward with a good heart and do what you can.
Listen, he is a dentist. He's not Rambo. So I don't know if I was ever like mad at Bernard for giving up that information. It's, you know, he didn't want Jin to die. That would have been sad. Jin's got a baby on the way.
He doesn't have the hard morals about both captivity and, you know, protecting his... I guess Jin is just, like, learned under the being a mobster. So he doesn't have the mobster or the torturer... He just has the dentist, and it wins out. Everybody's fine. Don't worry about Bernard. he made it. Even though Rose gets probably the best line of the episode at Jack, who she doesn't want to hear any of that live together, die alone crap.
So glad Rose and Bernard are back in our lives. We spent too much of season three without either of them, in my opinion.
They're back. They're alive. The beach is safe.
One good way to frame Bernard collapsing like a flan in a cupboard under light pressure is that they were threatening to murder Jin. And Bernard he appreciates beauty, right? He appreciates art.
Yeah, that was the last guy to help him with his SOS.
Yeah. Jin is too beautiful and kind and whatever to die. So Jin now. Remember season one Jin? Not great. Season now Jin? Too pretty and nice to die. So thanks, Bernard, for betraying everyone.
But yeah, it does work out because Deus Ex Hurley and then Juliet and Sawyer manage to show up and back everybody up. Juliet seemingly entirely on the side of the Lossies at this point. Seven others got blown up. She held friendly at gunpoint. I'm just saying, when we get to
if she didn't stop Sawyer from shooting Tom in the chest right there, I believe that's the final stage of her
initiation
into the beach gang.
And she's the one who stopped Tom, right? She stood. Yeah. She grabbed the gun that Tom was reaching for, and you know Tom and Juliet did have some sort of affinity earlier in the season. So, big moment for Juliet. I truly love. She kisses Jack. We all make mistakes, but then she has this nice like walk and talk with Sawyer, which I think is really good. Where she's like, I lied. she's on a suicide mission with Sawyer to the beach. That's her plan. So that, you know, if that's not full Lossy loyalty, what is, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Also, she mentions aliens, which is another great, just here you go. Here's more mysteries.
Yep. Building a runway for the aliens. Was she joking? Who knows? It's Lost. You thought a polar bear would come out of that jungle. It's a van. So Jack's mission finally gets us to the radio tower where Danielle's signal has been broadcasting, and lo and behold, Ben's there because of Bernard's blabbing, and has Alex with him also because of Bernard's blabbing, was told that Carl was a double agent.
Bernard gave up Carl. Bernard gave up everyone.
Yeah, Bernard gave up everyone. Bernard is like, that we have 2-hour finale and too much to happen for me to keep any information.
Bernard is like Chunk and Goonies when they hold his hand over the blender and he's like, and then
oh, Bernard. I'd watch a Bernard Truffle Shuffle if that's where this is all going.
1,000%. 1,000%. yeah. So Alex and Ben, everyone's favorite father daughter ? Are there
daughter? Yeah, which is nice because Jack has Rousseau from Explosive Plan, even though she's already mentioned that she's not going to get off the island with them if that happens. Or I guess
she's holding strong to her policy of not going anywhere she doesn't want to go.
Well, exactly. That's we talked about this last week in the storm, which is like, why didn't Rousseau just melt it? Like, why is Rousseau helping them? This is wildly out of character for Rousseau. Usually she's like a non-involvement. What's the political term for that? You know,
she's like the Switzerland of this island.
Yeah, but what was the
non-interventionist?
Yeah, non-interventionist. What was the U.S. policy? Anyway, never mind. Yeah, she's like, LOL, have fun with that. Bye. I'm going to go back to my traps. but this time she uncharacteristically helped them because the plot needed her there so that she could reunite with Alex, which is fine. I'm not mad about it. It's just like, why on earth would Rousseau be there with them? She's not a team player at all. So, she's there to meet her daughter and beat Ben up. What could be better than that?
That's what we want. Ben gets a lot of comeuppance in the second half of this narrative, where in the first half he seems super bloodthirsty, you know, having left Locke in a pit for an entire week of television watching time, but really for about 24 hours, from what I can tell, Pitlock wakes up, also reaches a dark moment, like Jack in the flash forward, and thinks about shooting himself in the head because he's paralyzed again on this god island that's apparently forsaken him, until the Walt shows up. He's not wet. He's not speaking backwards. He is speaking very clearly. He's standing. He tells John to get up. He has work to do. And Locke seems very happy about that, and it seems to work, because the next time we see him... Joanna, when's the next time we see Locke?
Oh, when he's protecting the rest of the Losties from a woman claiming to be there on behalf of Penelope Widmore, but we know that it is not Penny's boat. So she is there lying to them about why she's there, making potentially false claims about rescuing them. And Locke is like, let me protect my pals.
So you're saying Locke knows it's not Penny's boat because
Locke
Walt
knows that she...
It?
Locke knows that she has bad intentions.
Bad intentions. So he's on Ben's side.
He is a protagonist. Pro in favor of our other antagonists.
So that's what you're saying is what Ben is talking about in the first part of this episode, where he is saying
sometimes,
if she
sometimes
makes that
Ben
call,
is right.
Everyone's
sometimes,
gonna die.
Sometimes Ben is right, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
All right.
You don't think Ben's right sometimes?
It just seems like if a guy shoots you and drops you in a hole, it seems weird that you would show up on his side. But, you know, maybe the island's magic. I don't know.
John has had a really long day. And
and so he came out of a pit, out of near death, to save his friends. What a hero. Get him a crown of laurels. Get him a comfy chair. Get him Helen,
well,
heck, he deserves
I,
it.
As much as I would love to dance around the death of another person of color on this show and allow Joanna to score a point, no, he throws a knife into Naomi's back, right? She's about to call off.
Don't make it freaking
I will.
Racial.
Okay. They also shoot two women, and then Mikhail in the chest. And then Charlie, of course.
Charlie.
Who's very, very, very white and very Christian.
Charlie dies in this episode.
Well, we'll get to that. I just want to close out our little field adventure first, which is Locke shows up, seems very forceful about not getting them off, but will not kill Jack to stop him from making that call. So Jack makes the call. Someone picks up, and it looks like Charlie's or Desmond's flash forward is going to come true. And why? Because Charlie's dead at that point. Now we're here to the Looking Glass, the third part of the episode that takes place on the island, on the shore, on the ocean floor near the island. Who wants to pick up with Looking? Let's go with Neil. Neil, the Charlie that is in this episode has high spirits throughout, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Charlie's got a lot of, I guess you could call it not
chutzpah.
Giving a fuck energy.
Chutzpah, moxie.
I love the moment with Bonnie, right? Bonnie's the blonde one.
Yeah.
And I love that moment where he's explaining to her his plan, and she's like, "Yeah, but you'll be dead." And he's like, "Yeah, I'm gonna die." Or no, she's like, "What happens to you if this station floods?" And he's just like, "I'm just going to die." That might be Dom Monaghan's best line delivery in this. Because I know his biggest moment is not Penny's boat, but there's no dialogue in that. It's just his face doing all the work. But the best line by far, in my opinion, is when he's just like, "Well, I'm going to die."
Yeah.
And she's just like, "Shit." Like her whole face is going into a panic. It's great.
Can I? No. He's like, "Then I die." Can I die just really calmly? Can I do my favorite Dom Monaghan line reading of this episode?
Yes.
It goes like this. "You all, everybody." Yeah. "You all, everybody."
Yes. Where it's like, he gets the script and he's like, what? Oh, right. Can somebody tell me what that song sounded like 2 seasons ago when you told me I wrote it? Because I've just been singing Wonderwall for 2 years and you guys have been fine with it. Now all of a sudden I have to remember "You All, Everybody." But he does a pretty good job. No other additional lyrics, but, you know, he's been beat up. He's got the classic, the Whedon-esque, if you will, tied to a chair power monologue scenes.
Where's his little black dress?
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, I'd be into it. Just so we cut back and the two others have re-outfitted him. Let's get you out of those wet clothes and something a little bit more comfortable.
Charlie's just great in this episode. Dom Monaghan is fantastic in this episode. And, like, it's too bad that this wasn't Charlie's character the whole time. You know what I mean? He should have just been, like, fun-loving Charlie the whole time. So, you know,
it would have been
not stealing babies.
It's basically like an aggressive Hurley, and I like it.
Yeah, it's great.
Because it also wouldn't work, I don't think, if Hurley was like any more aggressive. He has his spurts when he needs to be, but you need him to drive the van surprisingly out. I guess I need someone in between competence, like in between Saeed and Hurley. And sometimes that's Sawyer, but then other times that's not Sawyer. It could have been Charlie all the time. Because he's good at it and charming about it and knows how to tap out Beach Boys on a keypad on the first try, which...
Okay, I have a defense of this.
Yes.
It's not a great defense. I feel like... Do you guys... Okay, here's what I'll say. Did you guys ever... You have your home number memorized from when you're a kid, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I can still sing my home number.
I can also sing my home number.
Which I'm pretty sure is still my parents' numbers, so I'm not going to sing the actual numbers. But it goes, do, 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 do. That's my you don't know the area code, so you can't call them. That's my home number. So I will say, there was once upon a time in the ancient days, we knew what sound the numbers made on a keypad. If I were Charlie, I would still need, like, one tone first, at least, to like give me. And other people rightly pointed out that how did he know it was the part that goes, I think he does, gotta keep those love good vibrations. That's the part of the song he does. And like, how did he know that it was the bridge breakdown was the part to do? There's a lot of good questions there, but I will defend knowing the tones of a keypad back in the day.
Yeah, this is definitely something that you could do in the late 90s, early aughts, still. You could still have that digital dial tone in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
It does not quite exist anymore with cell phones. yeah, I mean, it. I think it goes, you know, that it makes sense when she's like, oh, it was designed by a musician, and then Charlie's a musician, and it's just fate that brings them all together. I think what works super well about this whole sequence is just the timing of it. The way that you almost feel like they're out of the woods, right? Where you ask Desmond, have you had any visions lately? And Desmond's like, no. And everybody's like, oh, this is great. This is cool. And the audience is like, this is not fine. Something bad's going to happen here. And sure enough, our guy
sure
Mikhail,
enough, it's Mikhail. Yeah. He's not on the ground anymore.
You know, the Penny thing, the fact that it's not Penny's boat recontextualizes stuff that we just saw in the previous scene. The Naomi thing, which is like, up to that point, we believe Jack's doing the right thing, right? We believe that, like, you know, he's making this call. He's going to get them saves. It's just, it's Ben telling him that he's doing the wrong thing. And John Locke, who has bled most of his blood out at this point, telling him he's doing the wrong thing. So in the idea that immediately the show is like, oh, right, that's not Penny's boat. This is a complete mystery as to who Naomi is now or where she came from and who else is on that boat. And, I just love that. It's just, it's a great, this episode does a great job of like paying things off very quickly. While also, like I said, kicking over the mystery box elsewhere.
Yeah. And I also like how Mikhail has a little, testing of faith arc in this episode, where he keeps being like, man, Ben keeps lying to me. And Ben keeps being like, Jacob told me to do things. And because he has one eye, maybe, or, you know, for several reasons, I'm just like, man, is this guy gonna flip on Ben at the last moment? But he does not, and executes some Dharma people, and blows up the Looking Glass, or at least blows up the communication center of the Looking Glass so it floods. And,
Mikhail's... I mean... As we know, never count him out. He's always coming back. It's Mikhail. Like, we know that.
Right.
We can sing that jingle all day long. But I'm going to go ahead and just say that Mikhail is is definitely dead now because he was just holding that grenade.
Yeah, like half of his body is gone.
What's really fun is one of our calm listeners, Melissa, guessed weeks ago that the thing that could finally kill Mikhail is being fed to the Dharma Shark. And I really like that answer because I'm like, kind of true. I bet the Dharma Shark did snack on Mikhail in the end. So yeah, Mikhail, love that Mikhail had one last return from the dead moment. And then, yeah, I mean, I guess he was so faithful. I mean, do you think the Mikhail was like, this wound is fatal, so I might as well take them out as I go? Or do you think he just believed that much in the cause?
I think he just believed that much in the cause. Because if you're living on John Locke gets out of the Dharma Pit Island, that wound's not fatal.
I don't think Mikhail thought that he was going to die.
He thought he could survive the grenade. Yeah. Classic Mikhail.
He's like, I've done everything else.
He's like,
my novel is done.
He's like out there swimming very, like he had a thing in his chest, in the center of his chest, and he's just swimming like no big deal around with the grenade.
He has time to smile, to knock and smile. And
right?
Die.
He swam all the way around to the outside, found the right window.
He's
waited
like,
until the right moment.
He's yeah, like, dude,
the
dude,
taunting,
dude, just...
and then he pulls the pin, and then he waits to release the actual grenade timer.
Just committed a hate crime by killing two lesbians.
Yay!
Time for me to die. Yeah, Mikhail. Ben, pretty fucking tough stuff. Telling Bonnie and Greta to go live in a pineapple under the sea and not tell anyone.
They went to Canada.
Yeah, that was my nomination for lie. That Bonnie and it's not our lie of the week, but Bonnie and Greta are Canada.
That is a good lie of the week. our Henry Gale Memorial, obviously a lie award, goes to three shots out of the walkie-talkie, and Ben immediately says, "I'm so sorry, Jack," which is absolutely a lie. A, because they're not dead. B, Ben's not sorry, but. I do
wonder how many folks watching it for the first time were like, holy shit, did they just really kill off like three main characters?
I will say I'm really proud of our watchers because they were like, they're way too savvy. And they're like, no way did Daniel Day Kim just die off screen? No.
No way does Saeed, who is very good,
Naveen Andrews did not die off screen. So it did not fool our first time watchers. And I was very proud of them for that. I tried to like fake it in the calm. I don't know if you guys saw that, but I was like, oh, fuck. Like, nobody took the bait.
I was trying to, my thing I was trying to fake is every time we saw Bearded Jack, I would be like, man, he just got back from being forcibly kicked out of Thailand.
I love
just be
that.
Like, remember how he was old and depressed? But yeah, we have a lot more fun moments of vaguely knowing what's going on coming up.
But I will say that like in terms of the fake out deaths and the real deaths, like fake out deaths are annoying. But what I will give this like three shots in the sand fake out death is that the suspense doesn't last very long. They like cut fairly quickly to Tom. Like you don't have to watch. Mm-hmm. You have to watch Jack go through it and Kate go through it, but you don't have to watch Rose and Son go through it. So that feels lucky. And then there is a definite. Payoff to a promised death in Charlie, like Charlie dies. And so the fake out death feels less like cheap because they followed through on the other death that they were promising us. So,
mm-hmm. Which is good because they put basically everybody else in jeopardy that could be mortal jeopardy at some point. And you're like, maybe it won't be Charlie, but then it is. And it's good television because Jack has to go grow a beard. So we figure out what happens in that story sometime in the future. All right, is it time for the rest of our corners?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's do it.
Neil,
did you want to shout out Mikhail for...
blowing up a station. Yeah. John Locke would be very
pulling
proud.
Lock duty on the Looking Glass station.
John Locke's going to be so pissed when he finds out.
Still are. Odds are if you're a station, someone's going to blow you up on Lost.
I did,
usually John Locke.
I did want to mention a bunch of our comm watchers last week in Greatest Hits were like, why did Charlie have to knock Desmond out? That seemed really brutal in order to like swim down. But it's a plot reason. They needed that delay so that Desmond could wake up later and then swim down and rescue him. So like it's a whole, for plot reasons, Desmond needed to take a nap overnight in the outrigger because he's the way that time works in this episode, Desmond is knocked out all night in the outrigger. He should be very sunburned. And Charlie's in that, like, tied to that chair for a really, really long time. So.
And for Desmond Button Corner, which is a corner where we monitor Desmond buttons, it's still 3-button, 4-unbuttoned the entire episode, even as he swims.
I thought for sure he took that shirt off, but I guess
I mean, not yet. Things have not gotten that bad on the island of mystery. Or
maybe
slightly off the island of mystery.
His best buddy Charlie is gone. We'll get some shirt. Yeah. Some more buttons.
When he gets back to that beach and has to tell people what happened, I expect all buttons to be undone. Neil, we have quite the Giacchino corner this week.
Well, Michael Giacchino, as you know, the composer of Lost's score, really went all out for this one. And this is why, if you've ever bought the season 3 soundtrack, there's a final there's an entire disc dedicated to this episode, this finale, that includes 28 different tracks that are used somewhere in this finale. For this episode alone, the final track of which is called Flash Forward, Flashback. It introduces a new theme for Kate and Jack right there at the end. That one I like. There's also a new action motif for Ben, which this appears on the season 4 soundtrack. And I promise this is not a spoiler to say that the track is called Benundrum, which I think is guess what they have now that he's tied to a tree and has been punched a lot? They have a Benundrum to deal with.
Can we just shout out Michael Emerson's ability to take a fictional punch? Like,
I mean, he gets his ass kicked a lot on
all the time. No one wears bruise and blood on his face better than Michael Emerson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great. It's great. So yeah, if you're curious, go look up the soundtrack track list, and there's just like a whole disc for this one episode. It's wild. Giacchino had a lot of fun.
For the Boone Carlisle Memorial Falling Down Award, we decided last week it's vertical distance. This week it goes to Mikhail, who parts of him must be blown further down than the looking glass station.
He also falls down when he gets shot in the chest with a harpoon.
He does, after diving down.
He falls into the water.
He dives, falls, dives again, and then gets blown up in all directions simultaneously.
I'm gonna give it to, if I had to pick one of the falling downs, it's... Mm-hmm. Like I
Naomi
just,
face first out of the show.
No, I presume it's him like rolling off the lip into the pool.
No one is watching. Now is just my
like,
time.
I just imagine just like a flop splash sort of situation.
So. That's a good one too. All right. Oh, it's time for the Jungle of Kistery. That's where we poll our listeners on Twitter at Storm Podcast each week. For who needs to be a kissin', or sometimes it's people, sometimes it's people and inanimate objects, sometimes it's general ideas. We're going to catch up on some history this week. Joanna, 2 episodes back, the man behind the curtain, we predicted that Locke and Ben would be smooching. Do our listeners agree?
They do. When we announced that we were mid poll last week when we recorded, and so the front runner stayed the front runner. Locke and Ben won the man behind the curtain vote pretty handily. Through the looking glass. No. For Greatest Hits, last week's episode.
Yeah, last week's episode.
We had all humans smooching on humans. No love for our teenage renegades, Carl and Alex, 4.3% of the vote.
Ooh.
I mean, I will say this fun fact on the podcast. I said it in our live watch chat, but so, you know, I said a couple times on the Greatest Hits episode that how much I loved Carl's delivery of they're coming right now. It's like a pause, and then he says it. And I kept talking about how, like, it felt like a musical moment. And I didn't know this when I said it, but someone emailed us to let me know that the actor who plays Carl, Blake, I want to say his last name is Bashoff, but I could be wrong, was in the original Broadway production of Spring Awakening, which also launched the careers of like Leah Michelle and Jonathan Groff and stuff like that. So, yeah, so he that's just his musical theater training shining through in that moment. Great stuff. Okay, so no smooches for you, Carl and Alex. 4.3% of the vote. Rose and Bernard, 24.5% of the vote. That's too bad. So sad. Claire and Charlie did pretty well, 26.8% of the vote. But Running Away, our listeners said, gay rights. It is the Dharma lesbians, Greta and Bonnie, RIP, too good for this, too pure for this world. The murderous underwater lesbians.
I bet they were doing a lot of kissing before Charlie showed up.
44.4% of the vote. They quote unquote went to Canada all day, all night, if you know what I mean. And this week our nominations, which you can vote for over on our Twitter feed at Storm Podcast. This week our nominations are Saeed's Ankles Kissing Each Other. That's from listener Joy. it's a lot of violence. Actually, this is all violence. Ben and Rousseau's Elbow. That's from Laura. Mikhail and the Kiss of Death. That's from Kitalita. And the Dharmavan plus Ryan. That's from Matthew. So which of those deathly smooches did you most enjoy? My money's on the ankles, but we'll see. Very good. Very good.
That's the least violent just in terms of the nouns mentioned in the poll.
It's true.
Our book club this week seems obvious when Joanna said it. Joanna, what is it?
And it's Alice in Wonderland. We are Through the Looking Glass. I talked about this with our guest, Hua Chenbui, so we will talk about that a little bit more. But Through the Looking Glass is the name of the Alice in Wonderland sequel. And it should be noted that an earlier Jack episode, White Rabbit, is also an Alice reference. So there we go. Alice.
I bet it's a good time to listen to that chat right now.
All right, we are thrilled to welcome back to the podcast Hua Chenbui, who is here in season one so long ago, a year ago, we figured out, talking about some Sun and Jin, and we are here to talk about her true loves, Charlie and Desmond. So here we are. If you don't already follow her amazing work, she is a critic and a writer over at Slash Film. She's the best. She hosts a bunch of podcasts. We're going to talk about one of her new podcasts that she was telling me about before we started recording. We're going to talk about that at the end, and I'm really excited for you guys to find out what it is. But let's talk about Charlie. Let's do it. Let's just go right into what you really want. You're here for your the loves of your life,
Charlie and Desmond.
Desmond,
my boys.
Hit me with it.
So I have a confession, Joanna. When you talked to me about, when you hit me up about doing this episode, which we had talked about a while ago, and I kind of had forgotten a little bit, and you hit me up recently saying, when do you want to record this episode? And I was like, shoot, I've only finished rewatching season one of Lost. I need to do an accelerated version of season two and three. And so in the last week, I just kind of burned through season two and three with some key episodes. And it was really interesting watching it like that, because I felt like I had never done like a full on rewatch of Lost before, of the entire thing. I'd rewatch key episodes every now and then, like my favorites, like The Constant, for example. But doing a watch like this in such like a short amount of time made me just kind of reevaluate the show, because I always thought that this show, being so serialized as it is, would fit so well that binging model. But I feel like it's such a strange, almost relic of the time in which it came out, and that it was serialized, but it lent so well to that week-to-week format. And, you know, watching it as quickly as I did, I was like, oh, I can skip a couple of parts that were really tedious to me or that didn't really matter to the overall story, which it sounds, treacherous to say, because I've always defended the overall story of Lost. I always think that, you know, it's all about the journey and everything, but some parts of the journey, like, I'll just skip through this. I don't really care about Michael yelling Walt over and over again. Sure. So it was just so fascinating. Like, did you have that experience doing this podcast for the past like 2 years re-examining how Lost fits into that strange end of the week-to-week viewing model, and that the emergence of the binging model?
Absolutely. It's been so interesting. I think it is still a show that rewards a week-to-week watch. We have had some people get like anxious and plow ahead because they couldn't wait. And I can't blame them, especially like some of the cliffhangers. You're like, I'm sorry, what is happening? I mean, like this season finale is a good example. But I think there are some shows that can't stand up to a week-to-week watch. And Lost, even its weakest episodes, there's so much going on. Even in their failure, there's so much to like learn that it's been really rewarding to consider it really in that way. And you're right, this is the end. We're on the cusp of something completely different. And you know, anything that even like that Carlton Cuse or Damon Lindelof does next is like something that, you know, yes, aired week to week, but like also doesn't feel quite so serialized. Though the thing about a Lindelof show, and this is true of The Leftovers and Watchmen, and a ton of copycats, I've been thinking about this a lot recently, how almost like so many shows now copy this whole like, we're going to center on one character per episode thing. Mm-hmm. That Lost isn't the first show to do it, but it's a show that really popularized it. And that still gives it a like, oh, it's a blank episode, rather than like some of the Netflix shows you watch that are just like Umbrella Academy, which I liked season two, but like I could not tell you what happened in what episode of that show.
Yeah,
you
know, they all kind of blend together. Yeah. Whereas here you can pick and choose the episodes that are about a certain character that you like. And for instance, in my viewing, I decided to choose the Desmond and Charlie episodes, not only because they're my two favorite characters, but because I feel like they played a pretty pivotal part in this season three finale through the Looking Glass.
Right. So what was that like? Just a Charlie Des only journey through the series?
Yeah. So I remember when Through the Looking Glass came out, and it was, you know, it was something that the show had been building up to, that this was going to be probably the end of Charlie Pace. And it's so interesting that his personal character arc kind of finishes in season one. You kind of have a repeat of his arc in season two, where he struggles with his drug addiction again with the emergence of the drug smuggling plane and the Virgin Mary statues. But it's kind of, again, a repeat. And he ends up being at the same happy place that we found him at the end of season one, where it's just like this happy domesticity, this domestic bliss with Claire. And the way that this show like manages to make him interesting again is to give him this plot of being doomed or destined for death. And it's such an interesting little twist on that, on a character whose arc had basically completed. So by the time we come to Through the Looking Glass, it's like you expect it to happen. But it does. It's such a wonderful way of bringing full circle some of the earlier parts of his arc, in his feeling useless, his feeling redundant, and feeling like the best of his life was over and his destiny just came out to nothing. And here, you know, he is destined for one final great thing, and that is to save everyone in death. And it's such a wonderful cherry on top of his arc, which had run its course, but that final scene that he has, Not Penny's Vote, cements him not only as one of the all-time great characters, but it's also one of the all-time great Lost moments. I feel like that way that this episode and this whole season three in general kind of interrogates the idea of destiny and fate in a way that is, you know, very not as nihilistic as you would assume, because Charlie being destined for death and basically accepting his death, especially when you see it in Greatest Hits, feels like something that would be so gloom and doom and depressing, but it becomes a way of appreciating the life that he led before.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm just like in awe of how Lost walks that line in basically everything is about destiny. There's no, it kind of, in, if you think of it in like the grand scheme of things, there's no free will. And this is not a show about free will. It's a show about destiny. And like, it's a little bit depressing to think about like free will is basically like not existent, but the way that that Lost walks that line of making you embrace destiny in a way is so fascinating. Does this make any sense to you? Like, is that something that you picked up on as well, Joanna?
Well, I do think that, like, you know, Damon Lindelof said essentially this when we talked to him about like the end of season two and the beginning of season three. He's like, we didn't really know what to do with Charlie until we like landed on this, like put the sort of Damocles over his head of like a death proclamation. And that like, that all of a sudden gives his character some momentum where we had completely run out of any momentum to give him. And what I think is fascinating, and I was talking to our guest Miles McNutt last week about this as well, is like, we are trained now as TV watchers, I think, to, if someone's death is telegraphed in this way, to expect that they're going to do like a last minute reversal, like a loophole in the prophecy, you know, Harry Potter comes back, whatever it is, you know? And so, you know, like Buffy doesn't stay dead, like, you know, these people don't stay dead, right? And with Charlie, what I really appreciate is like, yeah, there's a little bit of playing with it in this finale in terms of like, you know, he says like so much for fate, right? Like you think a couple times, you think, oh, this is it. And then he's going to make it. And this is it. Oh, like maybe they're not going to kill him after all. And then he dies. And then you're just like, that was really satisfying. Not that I was like rooting for Charlie's death, though some of our first time watchers are, because they don't like Charlie. But like,
no.
He steals Claire's baby, and it's hard to come back from that. Okay, I have to
say. That's true. But
it just feels, yeah, exactly what you're saying. Like satisfying, that little smile he gives underwater of like, I did a good thing. I'm not useless. I did a good thing here at the end. I'm going to run this thing by you. You can tell me to like shove it in a closet and not talk about it ever again. But I feel like, and this never occurred to me when I watched this before, but it's becoming sort of like the end of Titanic for some people, this death for Charlie, because they're like, why didn't he run out and close the door from the other side? Why did he lock himself in there? Did he have to die? Like, you can make an argument like there was no way he's going to keep like Desmond or like what. But it honestly, I think he probably could have made it out the door and closed it from the other side.
Yeah, that actually occurred to me as I was watching the episode. And right. But I think that it just...
He was ready to go. He was ready to die. He's in panic mode. Like, I can make some excuses or whatever. It's just like, it does give like that one little like, but you know, he felt like he was sacrificing. He was fulfilling his destiny, sacrificing himself so Claire could get off the island, so Desmond could be saved, so that they could all know that that wasn't Penny's boat, et cetera, et cetera. So
I think it's just about what he accomplishes in that moment. It's about what he lends to the greater story. It's about him fulfilling his destiny, but doing it in a way that far exceeds just the brief Spark Notes version of it.
Right.
And I think I'm going to try to answer my like rambling question from before.
Yeah.
Walk that line between that nihilistic view of destiny and makes it actually a little bit optimistic. And it's what we do knowing that destiny, that fate. Mm-hmm. And in the interim, you know, it's not about just making it to that end point, but it's about what we're able to accomplish up until then. And it's all those little moments that that Charlie like has, where he, for example, cracks the code with his musician skills, and he is able to convince the dying other lady. I can't remember her name. I'm sorry,
Bonnie. I think it's Bonnie or. It's Bonnie. Greta and Bonnie, I think, mm-hmm. are the
yeah. Yeah. And it's like those little moments, though, that he's able to make the most of that destiny. And I think that's where Lost is able to succeed in dealing with a concept which is usually very depressing and nihilistic and existential, which is like destiny and not having that free will. But there is free will within this, that free will to do something before that destiny runs its course. So that's my little take. I hope like that all the Charlie haters, and I don't know why you exist. I mean, I'm sure I know why you exist, but I love Charlie. I love Dominic Monaghan's performance. And I know that he starts off as like comic relief and he essentially plays out that role for most of it, but he gives so much harsh to his performance. And I just want to applaud him in this episode specifically, and all the previous episodes too. Greatest Hits was just so fantastic. And he really just comes full circle here. And I adore him almost as much as I adore Desmond.
Yeah, it's a great 3-episode run for Charlie, for Dominic Monaghan. That, like, something I was really gratified to see is I talked about this a lot. Now I can finally talk about it in the spoiler-free section, but like, I've been really worried that Charlie's death wouldn't land with a lot of our first-time watchers who aren't enjoying him very much. And like, it's fine. They you know, it's not the end of the world if Charlie's death doesn't like wound them the way that it wounded the rest of us back when it happened. And this is also, you know, this is like before Thrones, like big character deaths like this weren't at like de rigueur in stories like this. And so,
And one that we were expecting and almost waiting for, too.
Yeah.
It's rare, because it's something that's been, you know, talked about the entire season.
Yeah.
And Greatest Hits, which comes 2 episodes before this, is all about, like, that goodbye tour for Charlie. And it could feel like something that's emotionally manipulative, but it feels so emotionally satisfying instead.
And it's interesting because there's, like, several fake-out deaths in this episode, you know what I mean? Like Jin and Saeed and Bernard and like, so, and we just had like a sort of a Locke fake out death and all sort of stuff like that on the show. So it's like, you know, you're like, okay, what are you doing, show? How, you know, and Mikhail keeps coming back and you're like, all right. But then like Charlie's dead. He's just dead. That's it.
One more thing I want to say about Charlie's death before we wrap up about it, is that it's the first main cast death that isn't something that was brought about by behind the scenes cast changes. I guess Shannon is the other one, and that's a big shocker. But Boone was one that we kind of get the feeling that he was moving on to, like Vampire Diaries, which was starting to pick up. Well, and Mr. Echo, I can't pronounce his full name. I'm sorry. Yeah. His was because of behind the scenes with the actor not being happy staying in Hawaii for so long.
Right.
And here it feels like it's something that the story calls for, and that's why that lends to why it's so satisfying too.
Yeah, I think Boone and Shannon, I think they just decided those characters weren't really working, because I think the timeline of Ian Somerhalder getting Vampire Diaries is like a little after. Mm-hmm. And actually, one of my favorite tidbits about that is that Ian Somerhalder said like he basically stole everything Josh Holloway was doing with Sawyer and used it for Vampire Diaries, and you could definitely see it once you know that. But I think to your point of like the importance of Charlie, because like Boone and Shannon, not to like dismiss them, were like side characters, and like Mr. Echo was great, but like, and Ana Lucia and Libby, but these were all like newish characters and stuff like that. But like Charlie, Jack and Kate were like the original three who trekked into the like jungle to find the pilot. You know what I mean? Like Dominic Monaghan was like Sean Bean on Game of Thrones, he was like off Lord of the Rings, the biggest name in the cast, kind of, you know, like all sort of stuff like that. So, it feels big. You told me before we started recording that you wanted to talk about love at first sight, maybe as it pertains to Desmond or the show in general. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it kind of connects to my discussion about fate and how this show treats fate and destiny. And I think that love at first sight is such a rare thing to see on television and movies, especially today, because it's something that is treated very cynically. It's something that's hard to pull off earnestly. And yet Lost does it not once, not twice, but 3 times. The third time will come a lot later on. And it's kind of something that's like in a kind of thing. That'll come later. But I think that the way that love at first sight and Lost is able to pull that off, both with Desmond and Penny and Charlie and Claire, is just so fantastic. And it feels so big and sweeping and romantic and earnest because of that idea of fate. And that's that. And it's because we've seen these relationships already through flashbacks, through present day interactions, that going back to those first meetings, be like, oh, okay, this is destined. This is what it was meant to be, so that it feels less like just two hot people getting together or like a flirtatious stare. Right. And it feels like something that is the bigger clocks of destiny are working, bigger cogs of destiny are working together to bring these two people together. So that's just my, I just wanted, this doesn't really have to do with the episode in general, but I think that this is one of the things that like stuck out to me while I was doing my accelerated rewatch. And I just love how Lost is able to pull off those moments of love at first sight. And it's such a rarity to see in TV. And I really love it. And I wanted to give a shout out to it.
I love that. Yeah, I think that that's true. And I think, I mean, part of it has to do with, like, of course, as you glancingly mentioned, the incredible attractiveness of this cast. But yeah, that idea of destiny and magic and like fates colliding that Lost creates by like seeding people into the flashbacks, you know, that, you know, like when Sawyer's girlfriend Cassie shows up in a Kate flashback, or like, you know, Charlie saves Nadia. It's like, some of that feels like a little cutesy at times, but like mm-hmm. The bigger feeling it gives you is that this is all part of a like inexorable plan. It was all leading to this, you know what I mean? And so, yeah. And that has to do with love, and that has to do with death, and that has to do with life, and all of that's true. So,
yeah. Speaking of flashbacks.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, okay, here's my question. Two questions. Leading up to this two-parter, what have they done to make it, to be able to dupe us in this flash forward that we think is a flashback for so long? Like, what track do they lay, if any occur to you? And then what are some of the cleverest things they do in the episode to keep you on your toes about what you're actually watching?
Well, this flash forwards, spoiler for everyone listening, I'm sure you already have that, doesn't raise any red flags at first, because for the past like season and a half of every Jack-centric episode we've seen, he is brooding over the disintegration of his marriage. And it's all things that we're familiar with and we've seen before. And it's starting to become a little old hat, maybe. And I think that that is part of the reason why it doesn't really, you know, stand out as being completely different. And there are a couple of red herrings, too, that I think might have been a little cheap that they threw in, which was Jack frequently referring to his father.
Yeah.
Which doesn't really make sense in the law, in the grand scheme of things.
Like if he's so drugged up, he doesn't know what's happening, I guess is the idea.
But it just that felt like a little bit too much of an obvious red herring. And once you like know the entire thing, but that was the only thing that like is a little clumsy to me, but it's because of what we've been used to, what we're familiar with the beats, with the rhythms of these episodes up until now, is that doesn't, you know, pique our interest or pique our
curiosity
yeah. that much. Mm-hmm. And so that's how they're so easily able to dupe us. But it's interesting because I think this episode in particular, with this whopper of a revelation that we're seeing a flash forwards and not a flashback, is a marker of the shift that Lost takes from character drama to genre show.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And, it has something to do with fate, like I was talking about. So it's the flashbacks serve a purpose in enhancing and making more complex the characters that we already know. And it only has, the show up until now has only had really one aspect of unpredictability, and that's the present day, when we don't really know what's going to happen on the island up until as they go forward. But with the flash forwards, it throws everything into disarray. Now we don't know what's going to happen in the past or in the future or in the present. And that, you know, is a way that in a way takes out the equation, fate out of the equation. And we don't know where their end goal. I mean, we know their end goal because they do get off the island, but it becomes something that is just a different way of approaching fate. And
there's a, yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, there's a lot of stakes here. Like, one of our listeners said something that I thought was so interesting in the episode a couple weeks ago, where we find out that Sun has conceived her baby on the island, and that means she needs to get off the island before she gives birth or she's going to die. And one of our listeners was like, I was having trouble caring about whether or not they ever got off the island. And now all of a sudden I enormously care, right? Like, does Sun get off the island? And we don't know the answer to that in this episode. We know Jack and Kate get off the island, and we don't know how. And we know there's someone that will be wondering where Kate is, but we don't know who that is. And we know that there's someone in a coffin that they both know, but we don't know who that is. And so it introduces all these questions and all, like, just put the foot on the gas of the forward momentum of the show in terms of, like, you're like, who, how, where, what, why, when, how?
Yeah.
Like, what's going on? Oh, my gosh. You know, and even if you have, and, like, what I think makes this episode so good is that even if you know that it ends with a flash forward, even if you have this big, like, quote-unquote twist spoiled for you or whatever, it's still an incredibly powerful thing that happens.
Yeah,
you
know what I mean? It shifts the goalposts of the show entirely, mm-hmm. in that beforehand you were just wondering, do they get off the island? How do they get off? And now it's, how did only these two people or the people that we might see in the future get off the island? Why do they want to return? And everything that happened in between is just a big blank. And it's such a great way of taking things up in this show. And it's also just, like, very typical of Lost, and, like, what I love about Lost, and that it really keeps you on your toes.
Yeah, and when Jack says, like, I'm tired of lying, you're like, what are you lying about? What are we doing? What's happening, guys? I don't know. So even though I do know, it's exciting to be in this phase, because, you know, and the creators knew this, that they were sort of languishing in their storytelling in terms of, like, they had run out of gas on a lot of the flashbacks. As you mentioned, they ran out of gas really early with Charlie, but they ran out on a lot of people about gas in their flashbacks. And this whole, like, island jungle of mystery stuff, like, was also sort of running out of gas to a certain degree. And so then they're like, all right, let's just mix it up and see where we go. And the thing, something that this finale accomplishes sort of retroactively, is it just makes a lot of season three feels so important, from even, like, Trisha Tanaka is dead, where Hurley gets the van started. And then that's, like, a hugely important part of this finale. You know what I mean? Or even, like, Sawyer shooting Tom and saying, that's for taking the boy off the raft. You know, that, like, that's a season one finale callback and stuff like that. And so, like, it just all, it reminds me of, like, Avengers Endgame, Avengers Endgame retroactively makes all of the MCU, including the Thor that nobody likes to talk about, important. You know what I mean? And so, like, this sort of, like, reaches back in time through Lost and, like, holds it all tight together and makes it feel important. You know what I mean? Charlie being a musician is important. Penny is important. The cable that goes under the ocean that they discovered so long ago leads to this place that Charlie's going to die. Like, it's all so important. And that's, you know, an Alex and Russo, like an Alex and Russo payoff. Like, it just all feels really tight right here in the finale.
Yeah, it wraps up all of these disparate character threads, and what before was just, like, this rich tapestry of character dramas becomes part of a greater whole of this bigger mystery, this big genre show, this big thing that, like, everything is connected again. Like, we do see that before, in that everyone is connected in some way, but it's almost like this weird karmic thing, and here it actually is something leading to something. So that's what makes it so satisfying again. And I absolutely love it. And it does feel like it's ending the arc of that mystery, of the island mystery, the magic jungle island mystery.
Right. Now is the time on the podcast where we like to thank our small council subscribers. These are the folks who are with us at the $10 level or above. We got a bunch of new subscribers, I think, around the finale watch. So thank you all for joining us for that. We want to thank Addison Lee, Elisa Ruoff, Anna Holmquist, Jenny Malone, David Woodley, Jackie Burns, Danette, Ryan Rabin, Brittany Cano, And Corey Hilsey, Kelly Grady, Fanny Martin, Patrick Sullivan, Zachary Silverman, Grace Richardson, Joshua Lane, Bettany Townsend, Danielle, Justin Young, and Harrison Fox. Thank you all so much.
It just occurred to me we let Joanna go first, and therefore she's getting, like, new names, and so we don't, you know, she's like, for all we know, she's pronouncing them perfectly. Here's a bunch of returning people whose names I'm going to do my best, because I recognize most of you. Thank you guys so much. John Stahl, Aaron Miller, Heather Ogden, Tasia Pender, Daniel Baltema, Adam Wells, Luis Collins, Michael Filippini, Natalie Muskin-Press, Tommy Fitzgerald, Michael Belitsky, Paul, I'm going to say this one, no, Tyrell is what we need to say because we used to be a Game of Thrones podcast. Dre, Christopher McGrain, Sean Strigfield, Warpstone, Derek Bachman, P, P, that is two with the letter P, Clark Ainsley, and Emilio Diaz. Thank you very much.
And I would like to thank the following lovely human beings: Cameron Fridrickson, Dimitri Portnoy, Melissa Horsefall, Marianne Cotto, Nate, Robbie Rapace, Jose Cordova, Emily Relf, Amy Gomez, Chris Miracle, Brandy Mandato, Julie Sorrells, Delane Mitchell, Amy Calhoun, Mark Tozer, Christina Sullivan, Jamie Britt, Saquon Gatling, Joe Janka, and Reed Larson. Thank you all so very much.
And we are back for the storm where my argument falls apart because the most heroic thing is done in between the flash forward and the current events, which is Locke kills himself to get Jack back to the island. And it's painfully obvious if you are planning also on your highest Locke antagonist moment to only be able to use it in the calm as this episode plays out.
Well, also, Naomi's not dead yet.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
So
I thank you for Joanna for letting me play along and take some cheap shots. But now, Jeremy Bentham, we have a long way to go. We have a whole season to go before we figure that out. Because correct me if I'm wrong, but we don't get that. That's like the last reveal of season four.
Not only that, but apparently, we should have said this in the column. We didn't, right? Or maybe we did. That only Evangeline Lilly and Matthew Fox and a few other people had
I think we did talk about
it. Okay. Had the final pages of the season three finale script for the season four finale when they revealed that it's John Locke in the box. They pulled an old Glenn on Walking Dead and filmed a couple different actors in the coffin to sort of throw people off. So, yeah, that's a season four big reveal. Da da da.
Oh yeah, and unlike The Walking Dead, this is a good choice of who to have in the box, I think.
It's a good choice, but it's also like it is a prolonged guessing game. I think the Oceanic Six guessing game is more interesting to me than the Jeremy
Who's in
Bentham
the box
thing.
Yeah, I don't think it's a great mystery box sort of thing, but in terms of here in the storm, the full arcs of the character of Jack and John, this is such a pivot episode because John is told directly by the man in black basically to like get up and fight for the island, and then the Jack that we see is eventually going to be the Jack that breaks and realizes he shouldn't, you know, had left. And that's the Jack that has a much more holistic approach to life by the time he gets back to the island and is much more tolerable coming out of season three. I think because of that. But yeah. Ugh.
Yeah.
John Locke's in that coffin.
Yeah. One of our listeners pointed out, I didn't realize this, that if you like freeze frame the obit and squint and whatever, it does say Jeremy Bentham. The Jeremy Bentham thing is I think kind of stupid because a bunch of like characters in season four, in order to preserve the mystery, refer to him as Bentham when like why on earth would they?
Yeah, it's obviously John Locke.
It's John Locke. So why on earth, like, when talking
probably to keep
each
the
other,
secret of when talking to each other, exactly.
Yeah, they call him Bentham, or yes, of course Bentham contacted me or whatever, and you're just like, Just say John Locke, you weirdos. So yeah, I think the and it was probably because like one of the candidates for the boxes is Ben, and I think Kate's reaction in this episode, why on earth would I go, makes more sense if it's Ben. Mm-hmm. She is pretty mad at John by the time that she like leaves the island, her reaction seems a little like, I don't know, have some pity.
Yeah, didn't you guys go through a whole ordeal?
Yeah.
And he also mysteriously showed up off the island, not by the way you guys got off the island.
So. Right. Via Tunisia, wherever it is he goes. So Jeremy Bentham, it's a thing.
It's a thing. And people are going to be, you know, we're going to be in it for another season. But that's, you know, cool, I think. It's interesting when you know the whole arc of the story, how much that article affects Jack in this episode and makes him much more sympathetic, even than I think he is at the end of this episode when, you know, it's a flash forward. But everybody will get there slowly. As you pointed out, the show has to figure out who's in that coffin before we get to, the full payoff. Who here thinks that Faraday programmed the keypad and looking glass?
That was me. I was trying to think of who's, because this is actually an unanswered question, as far as I can tell from a little light research, which is like, who is the musician who programmed the keypad in the looking glass? Don't we find out later that Daniel Faraday, or is this just in the Flash Sideways where he's a musician?
No, he's a musician. He's a pianist.
Okay, if I had to randomly connect two dots, Faraday was on the island in the past, and he could have been the guy. He could have programmed good vibrations.
It could have been Dan. I think a popular guess is that it was Horace. That I want to give Horace a lot of credit, but there you go.
Interesting. I mean, it would definitely be whoever was running the Dharma musicals, as we know are canon. They had seasonal musicals. Broke that on our show.
I do have one question about, back to the Kate and Jack scene at the end of the episode. When Kate references, like, I have to get back to him, do you remember at all who you thought that was? Because we know here in the storm that that's Aaron.
I think everyone thought it was Sawyer. You're supposed to think it's Sawyer.
Right. You're supposed to think it's Sawyer. I was very convinced that it was Sawyer.
So when you do the calculus on the Oceanic 6 next week, and we're going to have a fun time with that in the comm and the store in season 4, but when you do the math on the Oceanic 6, you're going to and you're making your list. Because I remember turning to Diana when the season 4 premiere happened, and I'm like, who do you think the Oceanic 6 are? Because you hear about the 6 before you see who they are or whatever. Mm-hmm. She guessed Sawyer because of what Kate says, and I think it's a reasonable guess. But I don't think we learn until Eggtown, which is episode 4, that it's Aaron. And, like, all through Eggtown, you're supposed to think it's Sawyer because, like, Jack's like, I won't see him. And she's like, you have to see him. And then it's Aaron. And you're okay.
Oh, the baby.
The baby. Jack hates babies. Okay. I thought he just hated Sawyer, but Jack hates babies. So that's fine.
Mm-hmm. Specifically his secret nephew.
Yeah, exactly. that's a classic. They're trying to make you think it's Sawyer moment, I think.
We also, this is a fun Lostpedia fact, this is Claire's exit from the beach camp for the series. Mm-hmm. Walks away from the beach camp, never comes back, goes to Dharmaville, then goes in the cabin, then makes her own squirrel baby home, and then gets a Jira'd right out of there to her happy ending. So
she might have popped down to the beach during her squirrel baby phase, but we don't get to see it.
So. That's true. She probably needed to get some tarps. You're going to live a tarpless existence after how to live with tarps all this time?
You need a tarp or two for your squirrel baby.
This is the beginning of Claire's even more feral Rousseau situation.
Yeah. They're trying to make her into new Rousseau. Is it interesting or not that, like, none of the things that Charlie leaves behind, either the list or the ring, ever make it to an intended recipient.
Realistic, but yeah. Also weird, and a show that it's seems sad. To be paying a lot of things off.
Well, I think it just makes it like I think it makes it more poignant. Claire yeah. never gets the list.
Claire never gets the ring. Yeah, Aaron never gets the ring.
The ancient family Pace family heirloom.
Yep. Well, you know what though. I mean, the list is probably dissolved and runny, but Lost 2, it's a DS ring somewhere on that beach.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Lost I'm surprised 2. Miles didn't find the DS ring, you know what I mean? Like,
I mean, yeah. He knew the diamonds were there and didn't want to go for it. Yeah, why would he?
Buy it and have a conversation with Dexter Stratton.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I remember Miles. Like, I can't wait to have Miles back.
Dexter Stratton, who's like haunting that ring.
Right? Yeah, his soul is in the ring.
Finally, I made it to the Magic Island.
It's his Horcrux. Oh, my God. Okay, can we talk about the freighter timeline, please?
Let's.
Sure.
It makes no sense. All right, can someone look up to me, look up for me while I'm talking about this, what day it was that Michael putted away from the island at the end of season two?
Okay.
Okay. So basically, we'll get there when we get to meet Kevin Johnson or whatever that episode's called. But like, Michael goes home, goes through a whole bunch of stuff, is recruited by Widmore. Well, is recruited by Tom to infiltrate the freighter team and is out there on the freighter this whole time. So Michael's out. Yeah.
The season two finale takes place on days 65 through 67. And this is days 90 and 91.
Right. So less than a month, Michael goes home, goes through a whole bunch of shit, and then gets on the freighter and comes back from whenever Naomi first landed on the island, at least, is when the freighter started dropped anchor off the island. So and not only that, but Tom had to go off island in that time, which I think is something we've discussed in the storm before. Our listeners brought this up. I hadn't really thought about this, but Ben acts kind of like surprised about the freighter, but how was he surprised about the freighter when he had Michael on board the freighter already? So is he just surprised that the freighter actually made it to its destination? Is he surprised that it made it there so fast? Like what, you know, like what?
It's got to be so fast.
Is the freighter not what he was like? Is like the whole. What is he surprised about? Just that the freighter's there?
Well, because he wouldn't be surprised that the freighter found the pulse that also took place on the season two finale, presumably because mm-hmm. he then right. sets up the jamming and assumes that it's gonna like happen.
And he knows that the freighter's coming because like Tom has, you know, in classic Ben other style, like a dossier to give to Michael, right? So like, I don't know. It doesn't really make sense. It's a fun way to bring Michael back, but it does. But for several reasons, it doesn't make a lot of sense to reconcile this episode with Michael being out there on the freighter. You know, mm-hmm. That's all.
Good crazy freighter math that we have coming up, and you know, we'll constantly be biting at the back of our minds. Is that how you say it? Like a tick, and not good. We have an email.
Yeah, sorry. I should have brought this up when we were talking about Claire earlier. It's an email from Claire about Claire.
Ooh.
Desmond's Visions antagonist check-in, says Claire.
Ooh.
Listening to your excellent discussion of greatest hits in this week's podcast, a thought suddenly occurred to me. Desmond's Flash is described more than once as Claire and Aaron leaving the island on a helicopter, which Desmond then interprets as coming true only if Charlie flicks the switch next to the yellow light and drowns. As we see in the season 3 finale, Charlie does flick the switch and drown, but Desmond's vision does not come true because Claire never gets to the chopper. Instead, it's Kate who takes Aaron on the helicopter and gets rescued. Meanwhile, poor Claire remains on the island, later falls under the thrall of the Man in Black, spends several deeply shitty years living feral in the jungle with terrible hair, wondering where her baby is, and only gets to leave the island at the very end on the Ajira plane. What are we to make of Dustin's vision being incorrect, misleading Charlie into willingly sacrificing his life so that the love object of his greatest hit and her baby could be rescued when it only comes true for Aaron? I assume that in real life, the show's writers had simply not yet turned their minds to the whole season four guessing game of which character will be part of the Oceanic Six and would have made it off the island along with Jack and Kate. But in universe, what is the explanation for why the vision is false? Did the vision correctly show Kate with Aaron in the helicopter, but Desmond has face blindness and confused her with Claire? Is Desmond subsequently consumed with guilt that his friend Charlie willingly died on Desmond's assurance that Claire would be rescued, but now Des knows that she isn't? Crazy town theory. Was Desmond's vision and greatest hits actually a manipulation by the Man in Black, either because he wanted Charlie dead and needed to give him sufficient motivation to drown, or as part of some scheme to keep Claire on the island to bring her under his thrall? Keep up the wonderful work. Thank you for everything you do for us. Claire, Aussie Claire in the Storm of Spoilers Slack. So, Australian Claire asking for a Claire.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a good question. Like, maybe not face blindness, but, like, we've seen Desmond's flashes. So, like, maybe he just sees a white woman and a baby.
It's like they're all the same. Which white woman has a baby? Claire.
At one point, like, Sun has the baby. She's holding the baby when Kate goes running back to, like, try to get Jin or whatever. So at one point, Sun has the baby, and at one point, Kate has the baby, because men don't hold babies. It's fine. Mm. But, yeah, I mean, that's a good question.
They wouldn't know how to support their delicate little heads.
No, men aren't trained to do so.
I'm going to say that it's close to the Man in Black thing. I'm not going to say that Desmond's visions are necessarily capable of lying. But I do think the Man in Black, just by the nature of his dark side of God thing, exists outside of, like, linear fate time while on the island. So it's the Man in Black's claiming of Claire that makes the vision untrue. If she doesn't end up in the cabin with Christian by her own volition, then she does it. She gets out on the helicopter.
I believe the Man in Black could, like, disrupt Des vision in that way. Were it not for him Claire snatching. I should say later. Kate and Son, neither Kate nor Son hold the baby, but Sawyer definitely holds Aaron for a while because Aaron is just, like, left on a random jungle leaf.
Oh, when oh yeah, that's right. He picks him up.
Hair, so that's
yeah.
Close.
It's close. Yeah, maybe he was thinking of Sawyer.
I mean, we haven't really gotten too deep into how accurate are Desmond's visions, I guess, but they could, it could very easily just be written off as, like, his visions are kind of imperfect and things change as you move through time, unless something has happened. We will learn that soon. Whatever happened.
Well, we have to, yeah. Unfortunately, like, you know, I talked to Jen about this, definitely maybe both of our guests about this, that, Charlie doesn't really need to die. We didn't talk about this in the calm with you guys because I knew I talked about it with the guests. Charlie doesn't really need to die there. He could have run to the other side of the door and closed it from the other side, or they both had time to, like, hop into the moon pool and get out of there. But the reason Charlie dies is the best explanation I have for it is that he knew that if he died, then Claire and Aaron will be rescued. So it's that's why I'm choosing to die here. Plus, like, a panic sort of, I don't know what the fuck to do. I just got brand new information from Penny. Des is running this way and a hot Russian is outside with a grenade. What do I do? So he made a decision. But it's like the end of Titanic where you're like, Jack could have fit on that door and you're like, Charlie could have made it to the other side of that door and didn't have to drown. So, yeah.
But so it was, fates, and now we're just starting to get into, you know, did the Man in Black do things? Which is great, because Tall Dry Walt is a Man in Black by post-series canon.
It doesn't make sense, which doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Once again.
The rules of the Man in Black.
What are the rules?
the body has to be there on the island, so he could have been Libby.
He could have been Libby. He could have been Horace.
To be Walt instead.
Imagine if Horace got him out of the Horace pit.
He should have been Helen.
Helen.
Let me lay this.
John.
No way. It should have been his fucking dad.
Oh.
Right?
Oh, Anthony Cooper.
Awfully hot for heaven, John.
John definitely would have shot himself if it was Anthony Cooper.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, never mind.
All right, here's my Walt theory, though. I got one.
Hit me.
So when Walt, earlier in the show, we remember Walt communing with the island and his magnetism that he has, and using the computer to chat with his dad.
Because he was inside of it. Yeah.
So at that point, the Men in Black was able to make like a copy of Walt as he was interacting electromagnetically with the island. You know how there's this idea that the smoke monster like scans people, but this is like a more in-depth version where he was able to just put Walt in the copy machine. Now I've got a tall, dry Walt if I want. And that explains where Walt pops up, you know, because if we put this all on Walt, or try to logic it out, it's very confusing. But if it's just like, oh yeah, the Man in Black, he can use a body, or he copied Walt. Those are just two things. Those are his moves.
I like Neil's preservation of canon. I do just think it was stunt casting, but you go as you go. I don't know, Joanna, maybe you actually know, do they still have future plans for Walt at this point?
I don't know.
It doesn't even know that they were bringing Michael back? Because that doesn't happen next season.
I don't think so, but I think that, I think they always wanted to try to figure out a way. Mm-hmm. And they want to keep using Walt because they don't, you know, it makes it feel strong, you know, like it feels really strong that they go back to Walt at the very, very end, you know, in the post series.
In the DVD coda?
Wrap up. Because that makes it feel like the season one portentous stuff about Walt actually pays off, you know what I mean? So I think using Walt as much as they possibly can, this is, of course, the most excellent use of an upshot angle ever to try to conceal how tall, how very, very tall, and bone dry Walt is. So, I don't know the answer, is my answer.
Interesting. Just knowing what I know from how the series progresses and sort of the things they think about, I can't think of another time. Like, outside, they have Michael come back, and obviously, you know, Michael has to do some lip service to Walt. But yeah, I can't think of another time it would be interesting to insert him. Wait, is he in the Bentham stuff? Am I talking... Does Jeremy Bentham visit Walt?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, he at least... No, yeah, he does talk to Walt. Yeah.
Okay, so maybe
And then we see Abaddon. I feel like Abaddon... Abaddon just talks a lot.
All right, stay tuned as my opinion on Walt evolves as I watch
series. Walt talks to John and, like, isn't John in the chair at that moment?
I feel like he is. Yes.
Right, yeah. So, like, once again, Walt being that tall doesn't seem that wild because there's been a couple of years, first of all, and second of all, Terry O'Quinn sitting down.
Why did we cast a child right at the beginning of his growth spurt? Curse you, fate.
But yeah, I mean, I'm so happy that we are doing this show. What a great episode, two episodes of television this was. And then, like, something I should have talked about in the comm, and I guess I'll just talk about here. Let's count down who has great shit to do in this episode. Michael Ederson as Ben, great shit. Mm-hmm. Matthew Fox as Jack, great shit. Naveen, Daniel Day Kim, the actor who plays Bernard, whose name I can't remember. Josh Holloway, Hurley, blah, blah, blah. Are you noticing a pattern? There is nothing really, really that great for women to do in this episode except for Alex and Rousseau, like, meeting each other briefly. Kate is, like... without real motivation in this
middle
episode.
Of the one corner of a square that only she sees.
Mm-hmm. She's ping-ponging back between Sawyer doesn't want to hang out with me anymore and Jack loves me but just made out with Juliet.
But it's just she doesn't really have a mission. The only thing she does that's kind of cool is like track At one point, she just like sort of silently lopes off into the jungle to like circle around and track Ben and Alex that they came alone. And then Juliet has like kind of cool moment, but really very, very, very tertiary. So like, you know, I'm just saying, do better. You know, Rose may have the best line, but I'm just saying overall.
Mm-hmm.
Get there. Oh, get there.
Another spoiler, woman gets shot get in the there. Stomach. And no woman has any, like, but we're right on the verge of Evangeline Lilly. I mean, she's got the final scene, obviously, in the episode, but we're right on the verge of Evangeline Lilly having the Aaron stuff be her central stuff, which I think is really effective. We can debate that throughout season four, but I think it's really effective to reposition her motivation around, like, motherhood, which is still a very gendered sort of type of storyline, but is at least much more interesting than the stupid love triangle of like Sawyer throwing rocks at her and Jack being like, cause I love you. And you're like, what the fuck, Jack?
What a weird day to tell Kate that.
Jack's timing. Impeccable.
Smooched Juliet and then went, cause I love you. What the fuck?
Now we know why she doesn't want to talk to him after they're off the island, because he just sucks.
And hates babies.
Hates the babies. Neil, where are we going next week?
Well, in what I believe to be a rare occasion of saying the name of the next episode in this current episode, Ben says at the end of this one, this is the beginning of the end, or if you make that call, it'll be the beginning of the end. And that's what the next episode is called, the beginning of the end. And it's a Hurley episode, and the mystery box will continue to just overflow as we roll into season four. It's great stuff.
Oceanic 6. Until then, where can people find more of your work online? We'll start this week with Joanna Robinson.
Oh, you can find me on VanityFair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. I have a couple other podcasts I do. Little Gold Men is our award season podcast, which is a really weird thing to have in 2020. And Still Watching is a Vanity Fair podcast I do, where Richard Lawson and I talk about a show we're watching, currently rewatching We Are Who We Are. On HBO, but I will also be doing a very special episode next week with guest co-host Anthony Bresnikan, where we'll be talking about The Haunting of Bly Manor. So if you want to listen to me break down Bly Manor next week after you binge it this weekend, that will be the place to do it. Still watching. Check it out. Neil Miller?
Yeah, you can get me over at the filmschoolrejects.com website, on Twitter at rejects, at One Perfect Shot. Also, for those of you who were streaming together and watching alone with us in our Slack, patreon.com/stormofspoilers, we announced this past weekend that on October 18th, we will be watching the entirety of Over the Garden Wall, which I have not yet seen, but I am assured that I will enjoy very much. And that's going to be October 18th at 3 o'clock. It's about 2 hours worth of content, so come hang out with us. It'll be fun.
October 18th. You could join me there for some potatoes and molasses. You could join me on Twitter at DA70. You could join me on another podcast called Fighting in the War Room, where we talk about pop culture topics. And although we're not an awards show, we do have Katie Rich, and they did cancel basically all major movies for the rest of the year. So tune in to find out what we talk about. It's super fun. And I will always be here at the end of every The Storm, A Lost Rewatch podcast, telling you that it is very important that you not fall down. If you are especially one of our treasured elderly, I watched Dick Johnson is Dead on Netflix this week, and it's really dangerous to fall down. It's very dangerous, like getting viruses are dangerous. So wear a mask, don't fall down. Wash your hands, be safe, and be nice to each other. See you next week.